This week on Retronauts, we hate every ape we see from Chimpan A to Chimpanzee. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm the leader of the bunch. My name is Bob. I'm finally here to cast some pods. And that's all the rapping I'll be doing, because on this week, our topic is Donkey Kong Country, a very important game that we've yet to cover in 16 years of Retronauts. And we could wait another 2 years for its 30th anniversary, but I refuse to wait any longer because these are some important monkeys and apes and chimps. And I think there's a bonobo in there or something. I don't know. They're impossibly related, but we'll talk more about their lineage very soon. Before I go any further, who is here with me today in the same room to talk about Donkey Kong's Country?
It's me, Henry Gilbert, straightening my big red tie to show I've grown up.
It's true. That's significant. You've become a man now. Who is our UK correspondent? Very important for this UK-based episode.
Hello, I'm Stuart Jupp, and I'm broadcasting not from Donkey Kong Country, but from Shonky King Country.
Very nice. Is Shonky King the new name of Prince Charles?
It is, yeah. I was satirizing him.
He sort of has big ape-like cans now, so I think that's appropriate. Yes, we are making fun of someone's medical condition, but let's go on. Who is talking to us from Japan right now?
Well, hello, it's Diamond Fight, and I'm wearing my lucky red cap.
Very nice, but it doesn't say Nintendo on it, but you're not being a shill, and I appreciate that.
And, you know, this is just like the game itself. This brings together Japan, England, and also the marketing of Americans.
And the American pigs.
Yeah, see, I guess we're the Play It Loud group putting the last bit on it.
Yes. Yeah. We just checked our levels. We're not playing it too loud.
Oh, yeah.
But, yes, Donkey Kong Country is a topic. We've mentioned Donkey Kong in the past. I mean, very important in Nintendo history. You know that. I believe there's a Donkey Kong episode of Retronauts, but this is going to be our first fully devoted episode to this game. And for this podcast, we're limiting our discussion to the very first game and related media, and I'm sure we will explore the rest of this series in future episodes. But before I go on any further, I want to know from all of you, what is your history of Donkey Kong, the character, and then later his country? Let us start with Stuart.
Hello.
What's your relationship with Donkey Kong? Have you been to Twycross?
I may have done, but I wasn't paying attention if I did. If Rare were there, they were difficult to find. You could say that they were Rare in themselves. Moving on. My history with Donkey Kong is, when I used to rent the NES, I used to, rent Donkey Kong Classics, which was so as I'm sure you know, it was a cartridge that had both Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Country, the NES versions of them. And naturally, I wasn't able to, you know, get anywhere on Donkey Kong. I don't recall that I got past the second board, but Donkey Kong Jr. I could loop many times. It's a very easy arcade game. It's one of the rare easy arcade games, in my humble opinion. But nowadays, I am very fond of the original. I also had the unlicensed knockoff version of it that I think was just called Kong on the Spectrum. It was terrible, as you'd imagine, but borderline unplayable. Not as good as Donkey Kong Country, which is excellent. I didn't actually get to play until many, many years later when emulation was a thing and I could play it on SNES 9X and go, oh yeah, hang on, this is a bit good. But I did used to read about it in magazines and long for it. I had a strategy guide for it for some reason. I used to read and just pore over and go, I'm playing this. Reading this is the same. It's a game that I've grown very fond of, and it's my favorite one of the original trilogy, and probably the whole series in general. That's not to say I don't like the others, but we'll presumably get to that at some point.
I assume you might be the biggest fan of the game on the podcast, but let's talk to Diamond. Diamond, where do you and Donkey Kong meet? Have you visited his country? And is Twycross on your agenda?
No, and I haven't looked up where that is. I'm assuming it's somewhere in a rolling hillside with some small, you know, knee-high stone walls and, I don't know, a cow. I'm old enough to remember Donkey Kong being a thing when Donkey Kong was new. I played the arcade game. I loved it. I definitely played the Atari 2600 version. I loved that one, too. It doesn't matter. Those sounds are in my head. For some reason, Donkey Kong and Pac-Man are like the two Atari go-to game sounds when like people make movies and things. So you still hear those sounds in productions today. I don't know why, but they're in my head already. And, you know, Donkey Kong, if you look at the Donkey Kong overall, you know, Donkey Kong I think is great. Donkey Kong Jr., a lot of fun, but I don't think it's as good as Donkey Kong. And then Donkey Kong 3 was kind of like, all right, I guess this is what we're doing now with Bugs. And so I feel like the character kind of ran out of steam there, you know, as Donkey Kong descended, Mario ascended. So, you know, when this game came around, it's like, oh yeah, Donkey Kong, okay. This could be okay. And I remember getting it, and it was like, this is fun, I like this. So when this game came out, I played it a lot. I have actually very vivid memories of playing this, like being home sick one day from school and just devoting myself to playing as much of it as I possibly could. So I know I eventually got 100%, or was it 101%, I think? But yeah, I did eventually just completely clear this game. So I put a lot of time into this one, and I did enjoy it very much. Although I didn't really return to the series at all, so I don't know anything about the Diddy's Kongs and the lands, and so this is like my one and only stop in Donkey Kong Country.
So we have two experts on our hands now.
Yeah.
Henry, how about you?
All right. So yes, I love the Donkey Kong series quite a lot. I associated with childhood wonder because I think one of the very first video games I ever saw, other than Pac-Man, was at like 3 or 4 at a pizza restaurant where I grew up in Arkansas, and they had Donkey Kong. I couldn't even play it, but just, you know, the visuals, the sounds of it, and the cabinet art as well, all just was spellbinding to me. Like, I just fell in love with the idea of it. It was such a simple idea, and it's so easy to grasp. And Donkey Kong Jr. too, like, I really loved that. I was able to play that one a little bit, and that all just flowed easily into my love of Mario and Super Mario Brothers being the first game I truly loved. But then as time went on with Donkey Kong, though, like I think we maybe rented the NES version of it and Junior, but I didn't play it all that much. I only truly came to appreciate original Donkey Kong when playing one of my favorite games of all time, Donkey Kong 94, which this podcast isn't about. But DKC... me and my brother played Country a lot when it first came out. It was a rental, though. We didn't buy it because we did deem it to be too hard for us to beat together. But I will say the marketing worked on us so good. It's amazing to play it now and to think about, like, no, because of the marketing, I saw something so much better than what I see on screen now, even though it is the exact same game. Like, that was the magic of the marketing on it. And because I love Donkey Kong, the man, the ape man, when he was not playable in the sequel, I was already like, nope, not doing it. Didn't touch it. I didn't touch any of the other DKCs.
Huge mistake.
Until the Wii time, yes. Yeah,
I don't know why they did that. As for me, I didn't play the original Donkey Kong or any of the Donkey Kong games, the early ones, until after Mario, because some of the first arcade games I ever played were Kangaroo, Ms. Pac-Man, and then the original Mario Brothers is where I really fell in love with video games. I love the original Mario Brothers so much. And only after playing, Super Mario and stuff did I go back and play Donkey Kong. And I was like, these games are kind of dated, but they're all right. I hate Donkey Kong Jr., though. when I play that again, I'm like, this hitbox is preposterous, sir. How you expect me to control this thing? It's like a different shape no matter which way you move it. Anyhow, yeah, so time passes, and I forget about Donkey Kong. He's like a reference in Nintendo games for a while. We'll talk about that. There's like a dormancy period for Donkey Kong. And then, of course, yes, the console wars are ramping up. We're all getting invested in this as young people. And yes, I am properly marketed to. We'll talk about the marketing for this game. It was laser-honed on all of us adolescents. And it worked very well. I asked for this game for Christmas of 94, and I got it for Christmas of 94, but I made a major mistake in that I asked for it for Christmas. It was on my Christmas list, but I rent games every weekend, and I saw it for rent, and I made the mistake of renting that game, so it wasn't as special when I got it for Christmas. I was like, I already played half of this. Why did I rent the game? I asked my parents for this.
You played yourself, Bob.
Yeah, big mistake. Yes, I really did. It was an early example of me playing myself. But yes, I did enjoy it at the time. I have a lot of memories of like everyone I know having this game and playing this game. But my reaction was, when I was playing it, was like, I like this and it's so pretty, but it's pretty simple. And I still walk away with that in my head today. Like, this is not the direction game design was going. It was the direction graphics were going, but it's interesting to see this type of game come out in 94 with what I feel is like antiquated game design, but cutting edge, bleeding edge graphical technology, technically. Yeah. And then, like, I dabbled a bit in renting Donkey Kong Country 2 and 3 again, like you, Henry. I'm like, why is the big man not here? Like, what are you doing? played a tiny bit of the 64 game, and then I was completely out for Returns. But then I was unemployed for a year after 1UP shut down, and I needed money. And Jeremy was working for US Gamer. I was not working there yet. And I reviewed Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. And I thought, I'm only playing this because I need money. But I ended up really liking that game. I like that game. I think it's a very, very good game. Better than the new Super Mario Brothers series. So I love that game. And I'm waiting for the next one. But yeah, it took me until Tropical Freeze to really like Donkey Kong Country games. And that's my own story.
I'm with you. It's better than the new Mario. The best new Mario Brothers game is... I still put it below Tropical Freeze. Like, Returns...
I'm quitting. I quit.
Returns is pretty good, but Tropical Freeze, and that's why it's even sadder that that game is so old now.
It's almost a decade old. And you know what? Tropical Freeze never asked me to blow into anything, unlike those awful Mario Man.
And none of the... like, the music way better in the Tropical Freeze.
Absolutely. Much better music. So yes, let's talk about Donkey Kong and Rare before Donkey Kong Country. So, you know, we can go over the basics. It can be a bit reductive. Donkey Kong, obviously a huge hit. It saves Nintendo's arcade division. It makes Nintendo a name in the arcades. The Famicom essentially is made to be the home Donkey Kong machine. They make hardware for one-screen arcade games, and they have to start adding chips on the cartridges to make them more, bigger in scope is what I want to say. So... yes, Donkey Kong is basically MIA for a decade because we have Donkey Kong, we have Donkey Kong Jr., and then we have Donkey Kong 3. And in my own, from my own experience, Donkey Kong 3 was so unloved that I only found out about it in like the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's like, did you know there was a Donkey Kong 3? I didn't know until maybe like 1999.
I think it was a minigame in WarioWare or something. It was Donkey Kong 3, and I was like, what the hell is this? You know, and I kind of like that game now. It's kind of not Donkey Kong, but I kind of dig it. It's okay. There's an alternate reality where we're all playing Stanley the Bug Exterminator Sunshine or something.
It's a nice little Galaga clone. That's what I like about it, like when I play it. But I have only pretty much every time I played Donkey Kong 3, it's at... on free play at some sort of arcade collection, and I play it for 5 minutes, like, yeah, all right, okay. Yeah. And I just walk away.
Like, I can say I've played it, but, I mean, I honestly feel that Nintendo walked away from Donkey Kong because they were like, well, this was our single-screen experience, and now Mario exists as Super Mario, and that's our scrolling game, and we don't know what to do with Donkey Kong in a scrolling game quite yet. There is a very brief mention of something called Return of Donkey Kong in a few pieces of official Nintendo literature. Not very descriptive as to what it is, just that it's coming, but it never materialized and nothing of it ever came surface for the public, even with all the Nintendo leaks. So who knows if that was just a pitch or like notes or design doc or whatever, but at some point maybe there was a Return of Donkey Kong game in the mid to late 80s happening within Nintendo.
Let's not forget about the promise, but eventually never resurfaced, the Donkey Kong Music School or Music Fun? For the Famicom, that was one of those games that's been announced, and we saw it in advertisements, but it's never been seen, not even with all those Giga Leaks. No one knows what happened to that game.
Man. You know, if Popeye can teach us English, then Donkey Kong can teach us music.
I technically really don't want to count those, even though they do count, because it's just like, let's just go to the asset factory, drop some Donkey Kong things in your cart, and make a math game, which is like... we technically, Donkey Kong Jr. Math is part of the Donkey Kong like experience, but
that's like that pinball NES pinball game is technically a Donkey Kong game and a Mario game.
Yeah,
we don't like to talk about it.
Henry, I'm sorry, I'm a little hung up on what you said about Popeye teaching English. He has no business doing such a thing.
You would think so.
He's incomprehensible. He talks Rubbish. Sorry, you know, I'm moving on.
We'd have to ask a generation of Japanese children if Popeye helped them learn English any better through a Famicom game.
That game is predicated on the idea that Popeye also knows Japanese and is fluent in it. And I've never heard Popeye dubbed in Japanese. Maybe it's good. Maybe
I
it's
gotta
good.
Give that. Yeah,
he would say like Itadaki Max or something. Itadaki Mask.
A mask. Yeah, he'd have to go out, like, yeah.
He would say foo-foo-foo-foo-foo instead of whatever. I'm not...
Instead of ga-ga-ga-ga.
Yeah, there you go. I'm not a regular Perfect. Joey Gladstone over
Where's
here.
Where's Nina when you need her?
Exactly. I should have her on this call. But yeah, like basically between 1983 and 1993, Donkey Kong is a cameo. Donkey Kong is like an Easter egg. I'm looking at like a list of Donkey Kong appearances. He's not in his own games, but he's in like Punch-Out and Super Punch-Out for the arcade. He's in Tetris. He's in F1 Race. He's in NES Open Tournament Golf. And yeah, just like a fun character. Remember him? He was a big arcade guy. Now, well, Mario's the main man, but we still acknowledge him.
The Simpsons even made fun of that, like, oh, nobody wants Donkey Kong anymore.
Oh, God, that joke is so weird.
He still got it.
I love it. That whole episode, man. Oh, my God.
But, yeah, I mean, he was mainly MIA, and the biggest role Donkey Kong had in a Nintendo game, and this surprised me as an 11-year-old, is when a year before Donkey Kong Country comes out, about 18 months before it comes out, they need another racer in Mario Kart, and it's Donkey Kong Jr. And it's just like, it always seems so odd to me playing that game as a kid. Like, I guess Donkey Kong's here for some reason, but it's Donkey Kong Jr. And I don't like that game, but he's sort of like, they need another big racer, and Wario doesn't really exist yet. So that's the biggest Donkey Kong playable appearance in games in like a decade.
And it's like a large version of Junior, right? They call him Donkey Kong, but he's wearing like Junior's white little like tunic thing. Yeah.
So yeah, he's got the vest. Interesting because I never thought of him as having this kind of cultural kind of dropout, because they did keep him in the public eye somehow. Because whenever Donkey Kong would show up, I would be like, oh yeah, Donkey Kong. So that original arcade game must have been absolutely seismic to have that effect.
Like, yeah. I mean, we do a Futurama podcast, and the first thing you see in the first episode of Futurama is a Donkey Kong parody. Mm. That's the very first image you see.
Yeah, I would say to a generation slightly older than us, like, and for most people in the world, like, the first image you thought of for video game, if it wasn't Pac-Man, it's Donkey Kong. Like, Donkey Kong is the second thing you think of. Not even Mario, but Donkey Kong.
Yeah, I mean, say what you will about the quality of the movie, which I'm sure is dreadful, but you know, Pixels, I feel like, is a great snapshot of what like an entire generation of people thought of when the video games. Oh, you got Donkey Kong, you got Pac-Man, you got Q-Bert. For some reason, Q-Bert is sexy now. I don't know. That's Sandler for you. But
well, I gotta watch this movie.
Josh Gad fucks Q-Bert. It's true.
Oh my god. It's true. Yeah, it was a new low for cinema. And isn't Donkey Kong isn't the new Mario movie, right?
Oh yeah, he's played by Seth Rogen, though he doesn't talk in the new trailer. But yeah,
I hope he never talks.
Yeah,
well, I don't want Canadian Donkey Kong.
He's too busy blazing it.
You'll be laughing. You'll all be laughing.
He's like, "Hey Mario, I made this vase."
I think if I went down to the dispensary, I could buy some Donkey Kush. I'm sure it's there.
And a Donkey Bong. Has anyone done that?
Oh, know. I'm sure you can get your own. If I go to Etsy, I can get my own Donkey Bong. But yeah, I mean, it's so weird. Nintendo's biggest celebrity before Mario is just cameos for about a decade. But I guess that shows you how powerful Mario was and how powerful the NES was, that we don't want to really think about Donkey Kong as anything other than a throwback. Like, oh, remember those simple primitive games from a decade ago? Well, we've moved on.
I guess, too, you know, with the way Mario is marketed so much, at the very least to Americans, with the Deke cartoon and all the, you know, branded pastas and whatnot, that, like, if you call back to, like, oh, remember when he hopped around with a monkey and also he kidnapped a monkey and whipped him? Like, they, you know, they probably, that interferes with their branding operations. So, definitely, I had prized, you didn't get real Mario toys when I was a kid who could, like, actually, like, move around and be poseable like a Spider-Man, but I did have these little PVC Mario figurines. And of the set, they had one that like him throwing a fireball, him holding a mushroom, him holding a turnip that he's about to throw, like from two, and then him with the hammer. So it's still like that toy did reference Donkey Kong just a little bit, but there was no Donkey Kong figure with it.
Yeah, I had a few of those. No real toys for a while, which was a real bummer. So let's talk about Rare. Donkey Kong MIA, but Rare, very prolific. We covered the company back in episode 35, like 8 years ago, with Jazz Rignall. He's on the episode, so check that out. But to give a brief overview of where Rare was, they spent the late 80s and early 90s making a lot of NES games. I believe I counted 47 releases developed by Rare.
Incredible.
In that time period.
And every one of them brilliant.
yeah.
including some good games. They weren't all like licensed Jeopardy games. There were some good ones in there. And guess what? Nintendo had a friendly relationship with Rare. They were even publishing some Rare games. Those games include Slalom, RC Pro-Am and a sequel, Cobra Triangle, Anticipation, Pinbot, and Snake Rattle and Roll. Like, Nintendo liked Rare so much they were publishing Rare games because Rare was not a publisher at this time, and they were basically working for every Western publisher just to make as many games as possible because they were that talented.
Yeah, Nintendo really liked those British guys. Like, they work with them a ton, and I think they, you know, the story sounds, even at the on the NES days, like Cobra Triangle does like look graphically strong for example, or RC Pro-Am was doing stuff you didn't see in other NES games. It reminds me of the tale of Star Fox as well when we did that podcast of like that.
Oh yeah, that
Nintendo sees these British developers doing things with their technology that they didn't think was possible, and instead of like suing them or whatever, they're like, "Hey, let's work together. If you can do this with it, let's see what else you can do."
Yeah, it's very similar to Argonaut, down to the point where this game is made by a bunch of people in their late teens, early 20s. Donkey Kong is redesigned by a man who is 20 years old, and that's the design that they kept.
Unbelievable.
For the rest of time.
They all sound so young to me when I was reading about their ages. I was like, Jesus, who would ever trust a 22-year-old that Nintendo would hand over the design of like one of their major characters to a 22-year-old? Of like, just handle it. You probably got a good idea.
And now they all look great. They're only like 50 years old now at this point. Mm. And they weren't much older than we were when we were playing these games. Like, the people who made Donkey Kong Country had 8 years on me, basically. When they were making it. Because they were very prolific, Rare often dealt with licensed games, and because of that, many Rare games weren't great. I mean, they were work for hire, and they were given some time and some money for some projects and not enough for others.
Their Spider-Man for Game Boy is all right, I'd say. Like, better than all the other Spider-Man games on the Game Boy.
I don't hate the Nightmare on Elm Street game, but I think I'm in the minority in that one.
You know what? I think that's a better licensed game of theirs, Stuart. I'm pretty sure that is a better one for them. But I think my own theory is that by 91, Rare is turning the corner. They don't want to be a licensed game factor anymore. They are getting into the world of like IP-focused entertainment, and that's where Battletoads comes in. We did a whole podcast about that. But Battletoads feels like Rare sitting down and saying, let's make our own like prestige, not the word they used at the time, but their own prestige platformer where it's like, it's not based on anything. We want to compete with the Marios and Sonics of the world. It's going to be our own IP, and we want to make a fully realized experience, not based on anything. And that's kind of what leads them into Donkey Kong Country, because that's a big seller for Nintendo. It's a Nintendo power cover, and Battletoads has legs for maybe like 3 years, basically.
Hmm. Can I chime in? I'd be remiss in not mentioning this, but. But before they were Rare, when they were Ultimate Play the Game, they were a Spectrum developer. And that it was sort of like a return to the kind of glory years for there, because they were kind of the Spectrum developers. Stuff like Attic Attack and Saber Wolf and Night Law. These are huge games. I mean, you play them now and they're like nothing. They're like, you know, or like Jetpack or something. But they were really big for Spectrum. So it was almost like they kind of went sort of up, down, then back up again, which I find kind of interesting. They like treated the NES as a kind of, as you mentioned, Bob, like licensed games factory, I guess, to get the capital they needed maybe to go to the next level. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they couldn't even make games fast enough. I mean, there was such a hunger for NES games, and it feels like they had maybe 10% of the American catalog was just made by Rare. Mm-hmm. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but boy, they made a lot of games, and you wouldn't know it unless you looked at the title screens, like developed by Rare
so
Co. Ltd. or whatever. Oh, sorry, Stuart?
No, I agree with you. There are so many, like, I just keep thinking of more, like, popping into my head, just, like, stuff like Beetlejuice that popped into my head. That's Rare, I'm pretty sure. There's so many.
Rare was always a prolific creator. Like even as resources increased and they obviously couldn't put out, you know, 10 games in a year anymore, they still were like, in the N64 era, they put Nintendo to shame with how many games they put out. Like they could produce more.
We could make two games a year. Oh, sorry, Stuart.
There are a lot of GBA games as well. I'm just keep agreeing with you guys.
Oh, please keep agreeing. Yeah. I love this. Yeah. But yeah, 94 would be a huge turning point for Rare. It's when Nintendo basically turns them into a second party developer. Let's talk about how that happens, because despite their success with the NES, Rare does not go all in on the SNES, despite making this game that sells 9 million copies. All told, they only developed 3 games for the Super Nintendo. I think there's 4 games for the Super Nintendo. I think it's the 3 Donkey Kong Country games and then Killer Instinct. Mm. And I believe I counted 47 NES releases. So now I'm thinking of a few more. I think there's like Battletoads for the Super Nintendo. So maybe or 6.
There's a couple of Battletoads games on the SNES. Yeah.
Basically 13 or 14% of what they develop for the NES, they make for the SNES. They don't care about the SNES that much because they're setting their sights higher on newfangled 3D developments, because the company, their coffers are bursting with by developing 50 NES games. They have a lot of money, and what they invest into is silicon graphics workstations, and they want to get ahead of the curve because they're like, yeah, Super Nintendo is here and it's great, but Project Reality is right around the corner, launching in 1995, and we want to be ready for Project Reality, whatever that is. We want to be ahead of the curve.
Isn't that wild to think that they invest that far in advance, that they're, you know, that one, that they have enough money that they can say, like, you know, we can make it till we don't need to really focus on a big thing for 93. Like, let's buy these very expensive things to be ready, cutting edge, like stuff that only the biggest companies have. They probably were one of the few people in all of England to own those SDI machines.
I definitely didn't have one.
Yeah, I think you're right, Henry, to the point where the government of Twycross, it's hard to say Twycross, the government of Twycross was looking into their power usage, because they're using more power than anyone else in the entire town.
What's all this then?
Exactly. What's all this then was said by a police officer or Bobby.
I'm going to send you to the barrister for this one.
They were developing things out of basically a barn in the countryside at this era.
I apologize, Stuart. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I deserve all of it.
Henry's hatred is coming through.
No, I do want to say I mock British development a lot on this show. It's fun when I come on. I like it. But I love British culture. One of my favorites, like, I became a comedy nerd because I got access to, on American broadcasting, like, British comedies. Like, that's why it was Simpsons and Monty Python and Red Dwarf and all that stuff growing up as a kid. Like, and I love the British sense of humor a lot of the time in Rare stuff. Like, sometimes too much.
What if Cranky
is so silly? So silly, the later games. They go way too daft.
Yeah, they even use like British colloquialisms in the titles of games, like Grabbed by the Ghoulies.
Yeah, that was too far. Yeah. But
I would actually rather be grabbed by the Ghoulies than play that.
Ooh, hey.
A lot of us would. But yeah, so Rare getting in on 3D technology. We presume that the Ultra 64, or whatever you want to call it, it was Project Reality, then Ultra 64, then N64. That was going to be coming out in 95, so this was going to be the stopgap for them. But they are experimenting with 3D modeling. One of the first things they experiment with is the Battletoads arcade game. So if you watch a playthrough of it, or if you play through it yourself, you'll notice that there are 3D modeled objects, but they're not living things. It's limited to like stationary objects and ships and things like that. So just very basic 3D modeling, much easier to do than to try to make something like a living, breathing creature with this early technology. And then Rare decides to push it a bit further. They said, we've done this experimentation with the arcade game, the Battletoads arcade game. Let's try to make a fighting game with these computer-generated characters. So they make something called Brute Force, or a demo for it, rather. It would go on release, though, because Nintendo saw footage of this game while visiting Rare. They're like, hey, what do you got for us? And they're like, hey, check this out. And Nintendo was like, how did you do this? And because of this demo for this boxing game that I don't even think footage has come out of it, Nintendo buys stake in Rare. They bought a very, very big stake in Rare. 25% initially, that would grow to 49%. And this partnership ends in 2002. Go back to our Star Fox podcast, because I think the partnership formally ends like the day Star Fox Adventures comes out, or whatever, or the news breaks or something like that.
A dark day on the Nintendo forums on IGN for me. That was a dark
day. But a great day for the furries.
Yes, it was a great day to be a furry in 2002. But yeah, Nintendo was so impressed by this. Stories differ on this matter. Some Rare people said that they were given the, you know, their choice of IP to develop for, and some said that Nintendo said, make a Donkey Kong game. Whatever the story is, it's still interesting that Nintendo was so impressed that they bought it instantly and said, like, this can buy us time in the console wars.
Yeah, it's that. I guess that also shows you where they're at with Donkey Kong. That, like, you know, we've seen this for years and years after the, like, Miyamoto and other execs, but it sounds like he makes a lot of these calls that he goes like, well, I don't want to make more of this game, so we can give that to this B studio. Let's see what they can do. Like, I don't want to make another Luigi's Mansion, but if I hear a good pitch for it, or if I think a company could do a good job with it on the 3DS, I'll hand over Luigi's Mansion, or I'll let them borrow Luigi's Mansion. That there's no handing over of Donkey Kong to these guys.
No.
I'm just haunted by the terrible thought of an alternate reality where Rare made a Metroid game, and I don't want to think about that any further, but it's in my head now, and now I can't think of anything else. A Rare Metroid.
Man, I wouldn't want to see Samus with this kind of stylized graphics. I think it works much better for googly-eyed furry ape people.
I was going to say, I want to see like Ridley with big googly eyes.
God.
No. They'd probably call him like Fiddly Ridley or something.
No.
Yes.
No, they try to make it funny. Kind of, they try to make Metroid funny. Oh, no. No.
Some kind of rhyming scheme, I think, would
Metroid
work.
Metroid or the Rem is quite funny.
Oh, it is. It is. Yeah. It's very funny. So, yes. Also, at the time, Nintendo was like, yeah, this Genesis game, Aladdin, is making us look bad. I mean, we know how they're doing it. We need something as impressive as this. So that was part of the reason why they approached Rare. They're like, Aladdin is kicking our asses. Aladdin ends up being like the fourth or fifth highest selling game on the platform, I think. It's a huge seller for Sega.
That's really funny.
It's so easy to forget that was that huge a thing. I mean, and we lived through it, and I definitely remember thinking this is why settled by Bob perfectly on a Retronauts, of which Aladdin is better.
Thank you.
But it is why it was a childhood argument, at least for me and my pals growing up too, of like which Aladdin was better. It was just that big. It was blowing my mind to see, you know, the developers of Donkey Kong in some of the articles you shared, Bob, talking about like, yeah, we felt the Aladdin pressure. Like, you never think of Aladdin. I don't think anybody thinks of the Aladdin Genesis game as part of the console wars as in like on the level, certainly not on the level of the Sonic, but like this was more about combating Aladdin than Sonic, though. Definitely. I think the Keep It Loud marketers were like, we can do better than blast processing. We'll make up some bullshit as that's even better than blast processing.
Bob, can I just ask, cause I think I missed this one. Which Aladdin did you give the crown to in the end?
Super Nintendo.
Oh, yes, that's the correct answer. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah. And I believe...
I've settled the matter. Yes,
yes. I'm correct in all instances.
It's over now. Yeah.
I believe the Genesis Aladdin is made by the UK people as well. I think David Perry is Irish, but I think it's like a UK studio, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I mean, it has the UK feel of being lost in a bunch of bullshit and aimlessness.
Whoa.
Sorry.
A lot of trolling here. But yeah, it's funny how like these British studios are, I mean, not even funny, but interesting. These British studios are like the hottest competitors in the console wars. They're the ones who are doing the most with the platforms, which is not that crazy if you think about. That's kind of what British games always were, like the coolest technical tricks, not as much in sense of game design, but they're devoting a lot of time to getting the most out of the hardware. So we all lived through it. In case you're a young person or older than us and forgot, there was a console war happening. And Nintendo needed to compete with Sega and its fast, flashy games, even though their hardware was technically inferior in many ways. So this is their answer to Sonic the Hedgehog. It's their answer to Aladdin. And it's their answer to buying two more years of time before new consoles arrive. And we'll talk about the context of this release, but there are so many consoles emerging at this time, and most of them are massive failures. Although they're still like delivering at a higher level of tech than the SNES, but they're all failing miserably because they don't have good games.
And half of them are from Sega.
Yes, that's true.
I had an issue of EGM. It was like the 1995 Game Buyer's Guide around this time. And it was my only issue of EGM. And at the beginning, it has this overview of all the consoles that are currently out. And it's like seven or eight pages of like four to a page. It's insane.
With the console wars, man, it's like I can't imagine Nintendo ultimately wins and gets to be called the winner without Donkey Kong Country. Like, there's no way. The Super NES would still be an amazing system that we'd all remember great, but when it comes to the actual dollars and the finger things means the money, Nintendo wouldn't have won that without Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah, this was it. And Donkey Kong Country was given the project name Country because of where the development was taking place. So that was in Twycross. I said it right that time. Apparently, that was in the rural country. See, Twycross and rural, both hard to say. That was in the rural countryside. But this was before, you know, the huge Rare buy-in. They moved to a much bigger studio. But this is basically being developed out of, like, a barn.
That was crazy.
In the middle of nowhere. And, yeah, so Country makes sense. And also there's, like, the world and land naming conventions already for the Nintendo game. So it makes sense to just keep that as the name of the game. Although I believe in Japan it's just called Super Donkey Kong.
Yes,
I think, yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Which is a cool name. I would have accepted it. I think I'm glad they went with DKC because that is – it's a strong – label for themselves, but it should, I mean, by the naming convention of most of the, like, the Super Metroids out there, that I suppose Super Donkey Kong is the more logical progression for the naming.
Yeah, but I guess they would have to keep the Super for the IP, for the brand, and they would just be Super from here on out, right?
Yeah, it's
probably
true, yeah.
Wait, wouldn't Super Donkey Kong, that's SDK, isn't that a thing?
Yeah, they can't take that. It's already been taken by software development kit.
That's right.
Oh, you're right.
SDK,
you're right.
Made by an SDK. It's kind of wild when you think about it. Ouroboros.
So this is a big project for Rare, obviously. They assemble their biggest team to date of 12 entire people. And they get to
one
work.
Or two of them were just doing his tie. They're just working on Donkey Kong's tie.
Yes, just rendering the tie, spinning it around.
I love
textures.
That. It's so British. They're like, okay, redesign Donkey Kong. And they're like, well, he looks a bit of a scruff. Let's put a tie on him. There you go.
He's a proper gentleman now.
Okay, we're done. Show it to Miyamoto.
And Nintendo was like, you guys have 18 months to do this because we need to get this out by November of 94. They think at this time that that's going to be the last SNES Christmas. That will be next year, by the way. And they'll have Donkey Kong's Country 2. Sorry, Donkey Kong Country 2, Diddy Kong's Quest.
No, it's
Diddy's Kong Quest.
Diddy's. Damn it, I got it wrong again. I got it
to
wrong
be fair,
again.
To be fair, it's stupid and
thank
it doesn't
you.
Matter.
Diddy Kong's... Wait,
Diddy's.
Kong...
Diddy's Conquest. Get it?
Diddy,
like, his Kong
is
quest.
On a quest for a Kong. So
Diddy's
is...
Kong Quest.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Now, okay. Now name the third one.
Triple Trouble? What? The super... What is the third
man,
one
what
called?
The hell
Dixie Kong's Double Trouble.
Oh, for the third game is Dixie Kong's Double Trouble.
Yeah, I know. It's also stupid.
Because you have Dixie and Kitty. Even Diddy is thrown away.
Diddy just chucked in a bin.
Is there a Moxie Kong?
So, yeah, 18... Moxie Kong.
You know what? There probably is. Like, I didn't play all those spinoffs.
If we check the animated series, there's got to be 50 Kongs that don't go mentioned in the games at all.
If you get all the golds in King of Swing, you unlock Moxie Kong or something.
No thanks. So yeah, 12 people, 18 months, constant crunch for the team, but it's real. They're all like super young. They don't have families of their own, so it's like a lot of camaraderie, bonding over like killing themselves making this game. And apparently, it's not too surprising if you play the game, but inspired by Super Mario, Rare had their own approach in that with the way the levels are laid out, they're kind of like developing speedrun-friendly levels before speedruns are invented, in that a beginning player could poke around in the levels, but there is a direct path to speed through the level for any advanced player. So if you're watching someone play at an advanced level, it's very impressive. And if you watch speedruns of this game, yes, there is a way just to go point A to point B, zipping through level without stopping for a second, and every level is designed like that.
I'm not sure if I'm getting ahead of us, but the Game Boy Advance version released much later has a dedicated like time trial mode that sort of exploits that, where you can save your times, get ranked by how fast you play and what score you get.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know that. Actually, I didn't look into the ports of this game, but I know the Game Boy Advance one was like in 2003 or something like that.
Yeah, you know, and it looks like someone threw up Haribo on the screen. It's awful.
You know, it's also funny too, these different approaches, because like Argonaut for Star Fox, it sounded like Nintendo just like plucked them up and like, you live in Kyoto now, and just drop them there. But like the Rare guys got to do the work remotely, and hearing so many of their stories like, well, we fax this and they fax that, or like, or a guy who only lived in the British countryside his whole life, you know, that flies to Seattle and Kyoto to present the game to people like that. That him describing the culture shock was very, very interesting.
And they don't really name drop Sonic the Hedgehog, but it feels a bit like that. I mean, this is kind of a reaction to it in that, like, Donkey Kong is fast. He spends a lot of time in a ball like Sonic does. And like in Sonic the Hedgehog, there are different routes through a level, and some of them are a little more challenging to get through, and some of them will push you through faster. I feel like there's some sense of Sonic intruding on this game's design.
Getting blasted through the barrels is a bit like being bounced around by springs and such as well, I find.
Absolutely. I think so, too.
Oh, yeah.
The game is embracing, you know, sort of the attitude era of game design, and that, you know, when you put the game in the Nintendo and you push start, what's the first thing you see after the logos are gone? You see an old man remembering the past, and then in comes, oh, here's the new hotness, and I've got a boombox, and oh, look at me, I'm all fancy. Like, that's you know, to me, that's very much in the spirit of Sonic and those advertisements that are like, oh, that thing, those old things, those are old. You want the new thing. It doesn't matter if the new thing's wearing a tie or not. But like that's the attitude, I think.
Am I wrong? I might be wrong about this, but isn't Cranky playing the old attract music from the original Donkey Kong as well? And then he gets blown up
on
and
a gramophone,
turns into your exciting.
I can only hope one of our listeners someday can put a Retronauts on a LP, because I want to see Retronauts being played on a gramophone.
Ooh, or like a wax cylinder. Yeah, this begins with Cranky Kong playing the Donkey Kong music, and it literally begins with like a Gen X record scratch.
Yep.
Like, this ain't your daddy's Donkey Kong.
And it comes in with the boombox and dancing. Yep. Like, it's amazing. Also to know, like, in late 1994, they're like, yeah, Grandpa, get out of here with your game from 1981 from 13 years ago. Fuck off. This is what's cool now.
I mean, I know that you know, technology moved incredibly fast at the time. And yes, a game from 1981, very different than a 1994 game. That's just like us saying, yeah, 2009, sit and spin. It's 2022, and we're doing it this way.
Uncharted 2, you can't hang today.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Like, yes, I guess you're so right. This is all about how fast things move ahead. Like, there is a big graphical difference between, say, Uncharted 2 and God of War Ragnarok, but it, maybe this is just because we're old, it doesn't feel the same as looking at Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Country.
Like, oh, hell no. Yeah. No. It's been incremental, like, since the PS2 almost. Well, PS3 was a big leap, but then since then, it almost just feels like it looks slightly more photorealistic. I don't know. It's crazy to me. Like, going from, I mean, we had like microcomputers jump to the NES, jump to the SNES, and then the N64, and that's in what, like, less than a decade? It's kind of wild.
Yeah, especially if you play, I mean, we did the Final Fantasy IX episode, and it was like, oh, remember 10 years ago? Wasn't that wild? And now we've had, like, so many more decades of Final Fantasy, but it's just, like, it was very quaint when the 8-bit era was a decade ago, and you can, like, giggle at a single-screen game, and now we're giggling at this.
Yeah.
I giggle at you, Donkey Kong Country. But one good thing Nintendo did is they stepped in and they said, okay, Rare, you know what you're doing, but you got to make this game less difficult, because we got phone calls about Battletoads. We have support lines set up. So this game is still, I think it's a well-made game. It is harder than a Japanese-developed Nintendo platformer of the time would be, and I still have never finished it. I played most of it for this recording. But I tapped out when I knew I've had enough. And I think there are some good things about this game, but I feel like Diddy and Donkey, their offensive vocabulary is super limited, and they are slippery little fuckers. They're careening off every cliff, and I feel like your offensive move just sends you into danger more often than it helps you.
Yeah, it gets really bad once you get in the later levels and you have the ice physics to contend with. It is so easy just to jump on a platform, and then you just slide right off the platform without doing anything else.
And then the minecart levels also bring in the torture of the twitch-based, like, instant reaction you needed in Battletoads. I mean, it's not as cruel as Battletoads. Few things are, but the minecart level still had that. No, I mean, well, also, too, when I played it two-player with my brother, which is how we played the most, like, we didn't realize that also kind of Fs you when it comes to health, because it's like, we didn't catch on until a little bit in, like, oh, we're basically sharing a health bar. Like, if I play this single player, I could mess up once or twice and lose Diddy. But if we're playing together, we're like, we neither of us can make a mistake, you know?
Even though Nintendo fine-tuned the difficulty or told Rare to, it does feel very old school, even for 94, in that it's a one-hit kill game. Even by 90, 91, Nintendo was like, Mario can have a mushroom in a little box that drops down if you get in trouble. Like, there are no concessions here. And it would have been much harder, I think, if they didn't step in and say, guys, we need to get, like, Super Mario Club in here to, like, focus group this and test this. Because Battletoads was only tested by people who worked at Rare. And that's why it's so hard. I think Nintendo did their normal, like, play testing that they do with every game with this game. And I think that made it better.
I mean, difficulty is subjective. I don't find it as difficult as you're saying, because mostly the game, like, essentially just dumps extra lives on you constantly. And I wonder if maybe they do it because they know they need to.
Yeah.
Because while there is a save feature, which is, you know, still quite rare by this point, no pun intended, it's only every few levels. Sometimes at, like, four or five stages you get to save, I think. So you will have to play through some quite rough gauntlets of difficult stages because, yeah, no, you know what, thinking about it, by World 2 it starts ramping up to fairly difficult kind of levels. I think that level Stop and Go Station is on World 2, and that's an absolute nightmare. So,
yeah.
Although I will say this, I do like the fact that on Stop and Go Station, when you enter the level, if you immediately turn around and exit again, it warps you right to the end, which is hilarious. As if you're just going, nope. You're just noping out of the whole level. It's great.
I wish you could do that
with the minecart stages as well. If you jump over the barrel that blasts you into the first minecart, hang left, you'll hit an invisible warp barrel, skip the whole level.
Wow.
They knew. I know way too much about this game.
Holy shit. They dump extra lives on you because
yes, they do.
You're right, they know. Battletoads was not so generous, but still, like, the moment-to-moment frustrations, you can try a lot, but it's a little tough. And I think nothing gets people madder on these podcasts is when I say something is hard for my own opinion, and they're like, no, it's not! You're no pro gamer! But I will say that Tropical Freeze, it's about twice as hard as Super Mario 3D World. You know, very different games, but it is still, like, harder than a Mario game. But I think that was, like, the perfect balance where it just, like, I wasn't expecting it to be that challenging, but it felt a lot more fair. And, of course, there's, like, 20 years of hindsight after this game, or, so, like, 15 years, rather, something like that.
I mean, something I'm used to. That's why, like I said, it's subjective. But even the way you bounce off enemies in Donkey Kong Country is kind of weird, because in Mario, you've got quite a lot of, you know, hang time in the air to sort of think, okay, I'm going to land on this Goomba when I come down. In Donkey Kong, not only do you bounce quite low, but you suddenly start moving weirdly quickly in the air. Like, the physics don't really match what you're doing. If you hit a Mario enemy at high speed, you're going to continue being at high speed. And if in this game, you will just shift and change, and it is unusual and it is hard to get used to. And, you know, playing it on a modern system, the messy because you don't have the kind of blurry edges you would get with an old television, it's a lot harder to forgive the collision detection being slightly weird and bad. You can get hit by those things, I think they're called claptraps, the little blue, they're taken out of Donkey Kong Jr. Those things can feel like a dice roll to land on them. Like, if you land on them slightly too far to the left, you're going to take damage. And, you know, now that I think about it, yeah, I agree with you, despite the fact that I love this game and I probably always will. I can't defend it from its criticisms, because they're all pretty much reasonable.
I had a moment of that when playing it just this morning, of, like, starting up the first stage again. And I was like, all right, oh yeah, let's roll. You can go pretty fast when you roll. And as I'm just getting used to the feel of it, an enemy, like, throws a coconut at me and I died. I'm like, oh, right. And then I, you know, in Sonic, that type of moment happens all the time. But when you get hit in Sonic, and then it's like, oh, well, I stopped my momentum. That sucks. And I lost all my rings. I grabbed one ring. I'm fine. I'll start running again. Instead, with DK, when that happened to me, he like shook his head like, I'm dead, start over the stage. Like,
yeah, the hit detection is a bit weird. I mean, I think what makes it, it's unfair to compare this to Mario, but hey, DK's in the same universe and it's published by Nintendo, but like the hit detection is so good in those Mario games that it, you, you really can't do worse than that and expect me to put up with you. And it's just, I mean, like, I expect the same results every time I jump on a guy, and that, that doesn't always happen to me when I play this game.
Like I said, I love this game, and I'll get into why, I'm sure, but it's worth remembering. Super Mario World came out, what, 5 years before this?
Four years
before this, and it's, you know, I've talked about that game on here before as how it's not my favorite Mario. I still love it. It's 10 out of 10, but it's better than Donkey Kong Country by some, in front of almost every department. Like, so this big new Nintendo platformer coming out, there was definitely a lot riding on the visuals, because they were super hyped. They were talking about how it's like the same computers that were used to make Jurassic Park. That was the big line that they were using, I think. But all of it, all of the magazines were just like, look at this, for Christ's sake. Who cares how it plays? Just look at it. And, you know, I do think it's a good game, and I do value the simplicity of it. I think that's kind of what makes me like it over the sequels, which I also do enjoy, is this game that has this kind of linear focus on getting to the end. Because while you can go for the sequence, you can get 100%, it doesn't really change the ending. It doesn't give you access to... It's not like the true ending being locked behind getting 100%. It's just a number. It doesn't matter. Whereas the later ones are kind of like, now you can't see the real ending unless you've done every little thing in this game, which I don't really want to do. But it's plenty of ideas and gimmicks and things, and that's kind of, I guess, what makes it fall down over something like Mario World, which does have its new ideas, but they're integrated very comfortably. And in this, it's just like, on this level, it's just the normal platforming level, except the lights are going to go off every 5 seconds. Good luck with that.
Yeah,
which is like my least favorite gimmick in the game. It's garbage.
I don't like that gimmick. But yeah, Stuart, I think like at the time I was surprised when I played this and thinking like, wow, this is very simple. It's just a game about running and jumping. And then looking at it from like 30 years ahead of time, it's just like, oh yeah, this game is about a bunch of variations on very specific themes. And that's how they develop the levels. It's like, we're going to have an idea, and then on post-it notes, we'll draw every version of that idea and then arrange them in the order we feel is appropriate. And now when I look at Donkey Kong Country, it feels more like an indie game of today, like a modern indie game. It's like, here is one basic idea we thought of, and we'll do as much as we possibly can with that idea, like Celeste or something like that, where it's just like, it's a game about running and jumping and that's it, or Super Meat Boy or something like that, you know?
Donkey Kong Country was the Celeste of its time.
Yes. Yeah. In a way.
Donkey Kong Country is also about coping with depression.
I had the same thought when I
played... You know, I get depressed when I lose all my bananas. So.
Me too. But then they're like 39 cents each.
When you go into the banana hoard at the beginning and the sad music plays, Donkey Kong just shakes his head sorrowfully. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a video game. It's so stupid. I love it.
But one more thought about like simplicity in game design and how like it takes me aback sometimes, especially when it's like a full budget $60 release. I remember I got a PS3 because of Uncharted 2, and every games journalist breathlessly was like, it's just like I'm playing a movie. My girlfriend was fooled. That's how they sold the game. If your girlfriend is fooled by a video game, then you've won.
Yeah, that ad hasn't aged too well. Just like, don't tell your girlfriend it's not a movie.
She might leave me if I do. But when I played it, I was like, okay, the next generation of gaming, and it's just like, all I do is shoot at guys. It's like, I don't upgrade my character. There's no like hit points. There's no like treasure to find. It's just like, no, you just shoot at guys and then get better at shooting them. And I had the same reaction to that as I had to Donkey Kong Country back in the day, where it's just like, well, this is so well made and it looks gorgeous, but I can't get over like just how simple it is.
It's, I mean, I guess I call it maybe frictionless in a sense that you're supposed to move forward and see more of it and go, wow, I'm progressing. I'm doing well. I'm having fun. I guess that's why they threw in the secret areas where you have to like spell the word Nintendo, you know. But then those secret areas are kind of perfunctory, because despite what I said about the fact that they don't have the, you know, creme coins and crap like that, all you're getting is more and more lives. Eventually you've got 99 lives and you don't need any more lives because you're essentially invincible. And you don't want to collect those animal tokens because they send you to a bonus room to get more lives that then jumps you back at the last checkpoint, which might be halfway back through the level again. So it almost feels like they just bolted that stuff on the top when they made the game and went, hang on a minute, they're going to finish this in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
It feels like the thrill is gone when everything you get is just an extra life. Diamond, what are your thoughts on the difficulty?
Well, I just So as I said, I played this game, completed it 100% or 101%, whatever it is, back when it was new. For the purpose of this podcast, it's on the Switch Online, so I got out, I replayed it. Here's the proof. I did indeed restore the bananas to the rightful place. But
anyone could have taken that screenshot. I didn't buy it. You never played the game in your life.
But I remember as I was playing it again, I really felt... I was kind of surprised at how simple. I don't think this is me like with like muscle memory. Like, oh, this is so easy. I've done this before. It's not like, you know, not like me for like Mega Man 2. It's like I know every trick in Mega Man 2 at this point. It just felt very straightforward to me. Like these levels, you know, I guess on the one hand, it's not a bad decision because if you look back at if you look back at 1994, oh my God, there are so many platformers being made and a lot of them being made in the UK. No offense, Stu. And, you know,
yeah, they're all brilliant.
As Dave Rudden famously called them, like the airplane hangers. It's like you're in this gigantic space. You can go up. You can go down. You can loop around. You've got to find like 8 levers or something to get to the exit. And it's just exhausting. It's like these levels are all very, it's like, you know where you're going. There's no mazes. There's no teleporters. It's just like you need to go from this point. You're going from left to right no matter what. You know, you might go up and down a little bit, but if that's because there's a mountain in the way, you're like, you're never going to get lost in this game. Even the water, the water levels, which can be a little bit frustrating when it's like, well, I'm supposed to go 4 directions. Which way do I go? Even those, there's not that many loops you can take. You're not gonna, you know, you're never in risk of drowning. The enemies are about as slow as you are, except for those damn octopus things. But
don't like those.
Yeah, I felt like it was moving. It moved very smoothly. It went very quickly. I mean, this playthrough. It took me 2 hours to finish in game time. So I feel like, you know, for a game of this era, that's pretty fast. I'm sure, yeah, if I knew what I was doing, I'm sure you could probably get the game down. I mean, when you beat it, Cranky Kong tells you, I would have found all the rooms. I would have done it less than an hour. I'd be very curious. Is it possible to 100% this game in less than an hour? Or is Cranky Kong just lying? Is he a liar?
No, I can't imagine that's possible.
No, I got. I mean, they would have Cranky Kong troll you like that and tell you like you can do this faster and just to torture children all over the world to try.
Something about this game that you mentioned, Diamond, about all the levels being sort of more or less left to right. That is true. I mean, besides the water levels, obviously, there's one level to my mind that's not like that, which is the level Slip Slide Ride, which almost feels like it came out of another game. Because you're going up all over the place, left, right, climbing up like vines and such.
Oh yeah!
But most of the game, but based on the comparison to Sonic, it is actually a little bit like Sonic in the fact that the first zone or the first stage has a lot of verticality, has a lot of hidden secrets, like lots and lots of secrets. Like even the fact that you can ground pound certain parts of the terrain and bananas come out, like that's like something that even I didn't know about till quite recently. But it's like how you can roll jump across the rooftops and get like 10 extra lives. Or you can go down to the ground, you can break through the walls with Rambo, you do all this kind of stuff. And then almost as soon as you finish that stage, that drops like a stone. Like it's just like, okay, we've done our big showpiece stage, now it's just now we're just making filler. Like there's a stage called Winky's Walkway, which is funny because Winky means, you know, penis.
Yes.
And the level is about 10 seconds, 15 seconds long. Just run left to right, and the secrets are in full view, and it's almost like they realized they hadn't got a level, and they just needed to slap one in there before it got shipped. And then that's how it goes on that way. And like I said, I like this game, but it's incredibly linear, like so insanely linear. I can't think of a more linear platformer outside of something like Pac-Land. I mean, the original Mario Brothers had warp zones, you know?
I know it's not fair, but it also is inevitable to talk about this game and this is Mario World games, but it's like... This game has this world map, and it's like the world map is almost completely useless because, like, there is there are no hidden exits. Like, there are secrets to find in every level, yes, but there are no hidden exits. There are no alternate paths. You cannot, you know, jump into a barrel on stage one and find yourself 4 stages later. Like, that doesn't happen. The worlds are extreme. Like, you finish one world, you get to the next world, and, you know, Super Mario World, you know, you went. You explore through these different areas, and each individual area had multiple paths, and some of those multiple paths led you to different parts of the world entirely. Like that game has a gigantic map, and then like, not even talk about Yoshi's Island, which came out a year later, which had even more sort of, you know, surprises in store like that. But
though Yoshi's Island was completely linear, it's worth noting. they sort of ate the structure in a way, no pun intended.
Right. Mm. Okay, that is true. They had less of the branching paths in that one.
Though obviously there were loads of secrets within the stages, like you say. Mm. Sorry, I don't mean to muddy the issue.
No, you're correct. Yeah. But that was the biggest thing I thought of when I was sitting here playing this game again with the world map, and I'm like, okay, so each time you clear a stage, someone drops down a line of Cheerios, and you go to the next stage, and it's like, but why? Like, you know, what? Why is, you know, I feel like if you could push a button to leave an individual area and go back to the world map, if you could just do that, you wouldn't even need Funky Kong. Like, that would be his entire existence would be, you know, moot if you just had a button that's like, oh, I want to go back to the world map. Okay, because I actually Googled that. I was like, how do I go back to the world map? Oh, I can't. I have to go to this. I have to go to this crazed ape. And it's like
the GBA version. I think that GBA version dropped him entirely. You can just press start and go to Funky's flights anytime you want. They did actually make that quality of life change.
We had to wait until Funky Mode was invented to see his full
new Funky Mode.
Yes, I want to go back to what I was saying earlier about the design. And that I think it's okay for games to be simple, but just seeing it a game this simple and like the blockbuster format did take me aback. And at the time, like, before I got this, I had just gotten Final Fantasy 3/6 and just like, oh, the innovations in storytelling and just how technically complex all of the design is. And yes, it's an RPG. And I played Mario World to death. And it's just like Mario has like 30 verbs in his vocabulary if you combine him with Yoshi and everything he can do with all the items around him. So it just felt so simple. And I think I thought of Celeste because this game is very forward thinking in that it has coyote time. And what coyote time is, it still lets you jump after you move enough off of a cliff. There's like a certain threshold in which you fall, but you can roll off of a cliff and still jump when there's nothing under you. So I think they were forward thinking and kind of inventing coyote time in this game without naming it.
When Country Returns came out, I remember being, because I'm a big fan of this series, I remember fretting that they weren't going to nail it. And then I saw in one of the trailers you did a roll jump, and I was like, they've done it. Like, they've absolutely got it. That is Donkey Kong Country.
Especially Diddy.
Yes, Diddy, especially. Yeah, that's his one. Like, I feel like that cartwheel can just move you like 30 feet over nothing before you jump.
Yeah, there's very little between the two characters. I mean, all it is, I think, is that Diddy can do that a bit faster, and Donkey Kong can kill those army guys who are a bit bigger than the others. Whereas Diddy just bounces off them, and they barely even appear. They're in like two levels, so like, who cares? You know?
But you're saying
it makes it feel a bit like a tech demo, I think, and it's a good tech demo, and I really like it a lot. Like I say, I still think it's my favorite based on the simplicity of it. But I wouldn't be so bold as to say that it wasn't probably I don't like using this word, but probably objectively not as good as the second one in terms of what it offers. The second one feels a bit like they went like, okay, well now we've got that other way, we can actually, you know, make a game.
Yeah. Like, we built the framework, now we can expand upon it. And Stuart, you were saying, and you had a really good point earlier in that, like, after that first stage, the first stage is expansive, there are many different approaches, there's all kinds of ideas, but after that, it's just, like, them doing their most with the single idea and then moving on. And my issue with that is, like, so yeah, some Mario levels will do that, but I feel like if you don't like that idea, you have nowhere else to go with your life. You need to finish that challenge. And Rare has a real issue in this game with putting the nastiest thing like inches before the finish line in a very cruel way, which is a Battletoads choice. They were doing that in Battletoads, but they're still doing it here. Just like, I did all of that, and you do this to me at the end?
There's a level. I can't remember which level it is, but there's an absolutely vile level in towards the end of the game where at the end there's one of those claptraps that jumps the same time you do. And it comes out of the exit right as you're approaching it. Like, you can't even see it until you're basically on top of it. And then if you jump instinctively, you will get hit. It's the most vile shit I've ever seen.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. We'll talk more about the designs soon. I want to get through the history. There's some interesting things here. So, yes, Miyamoto suggests the tie for Donkey Kong, and I'm sure that's going in tandem with the relaunch of Donkey Kong for the Game Boy, in that he's got a tie there as well. And, yes, Skip Bayless designed the Battletoads. So Donkey Kong shares some traits, and this will ruin Donkey Kong forever. If you look at the newer version of Donkey Kong, he is basically a brown Battletoad.
It has ruined it for me. I can't believe I played so much Battletoads. I've played this. I have known this as the Donkey Kong like vision, like Donkey Kong, even in that Illumination trailer for the most recent trailer that debuted Donkey Kong for that movie. It's still the same kind of brow and face. Like, it's it's still, and it never hit me that it's a Battletoad.
Go ahead, Stuart.
I was just going to make a really stupid joke, to be honest.
Go for
I was going to say,
it.
Which skin condition would we name the Donkey Kong Battletoad after?
He's scabies.
I love it.
Yes. I mean, they've adjusted the model over time. They make it a lot less harsh because this is very early character modeling, to the point where they're like kind of like sausage links jammed together and they're clipping through each other. I think the eyes are a little less set back in his head now. But yeah, he started life as a brown Battletoad. And I can teach you about the journey towards Diddy Kong. And according to Greg Males of Rare, here's his quote. Quote, we initially wanted to include DK Jr. as Donkey's sidekick. Diddy Kong was our update of Jr., but Nintendo felt that the character was too different and either wanted Jr. to be included in his original look or the name of our new character to be changed. We felt that our new character perfectly suited the updated universe of Donkey Kong, so we kept our character and gave him a different name. We had a sheet of paper that we passed around where potential names were scribbled down. Some were hilariously bad. Diet DK, DK Lite, and Titchy Kong. Ew. We settled on Dinky Kong, but after legal advice, changed it to Diddy. Yes, there was a copyright on the phrase, on the word Dinky from some toy manufacturer. And Stuart, I've been told, based on some interviews about the subject, Diddy is British slang. Is that true?
Yeah, well, there's a... Oh, my God, I can't believe I'm mentioning this guy on Retronauts, but there's a British comedian, or was a British comedian, called Ken Dodd, who would run around with a feather duster, and he had, like, very prominent teeth, and he did six-hour gigs.
Jesus.
But anyway, the point is... Sorry, this is not about Ken Dodd. The point is he had sidekicks who he called the Diddy Men. It's pretty un-PC, to be honest, but that's how I know the word Diddy. Basically.
I see. Okay.
I didn't know it had certain connotations.
Well, let's just think of it as a cute little ape guy then.
Yeah.
I guess Diddy means small, but when you're referring to Diddy Man, I think what you're referring to there is, I don't actually know what the correct nomenclature is. What do we call little people?
Yeah. I see.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
So, yeah, the British there, I know we don't normally do things like that. We don't normally, you know, do faux pas that we look back on later and think, oh, that's incredibly offensive and or racist and or sexist. But, you know, this time we did.
Hey, same with Americans.
I was worried you're going to say it dates back to it was made up by Jimmy Savile.
If it's any consolation, Ken Dodd dead skeleton by now.
So we've been with, like, Diddy's been with us for a very long time.
I'm so glad it's not DK Jr. The DK Jr., he can still show up and be in his little onesie in the rare times you see him.
Is he like in the tennis games now or something?
He definitely was in a tennis game. I think he was put in, you know, I'm just going to have to go to the Mario Wiki when I'm saying these things, but I'm pretty sure they have put him in more stuff lately than you would have thought of. But for a long time, he was gone. But me as a kid, I thought like, oh, so he's... I mean, we could go through a whole thing about what who's related to who and what characters are the old versions of other characters in this, but it confused me as a kid, yeah.
I always wondered if that was complete fan headcanon crap or if there was anything supporting that, because everyone always used to say that Cranky Kong was the original Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong in this game was Donkey Kong Jr., but where's the basis for that?
The joke that starts this is that, like, I mean, there is some of that. I think if you ask Miyamoto, he'd say that is definitely not true. But
yeah,
I think some folks at Rare did think that.
Oh, no, definitely internally at Rare, the thought was, yeah, Cranky Kong is the original Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong is Donkey Kong Jr. But I don't think they were allowed to put that down as like the lore of the game. Because I think they originally wrote like 8 pages of lore. Nintendo's like, make it a paragraph. Donkey Kong and his bananas are missing. So I think like internally, just for this game, Cranky Kong is original DK, which is why when you visit him and have to sit through him ranting about kids these days before he actually gives you tips, some of them are like, I only had one screen and I had my life fine. Everything was great. Who needs scrolling?
I love that he's a guy who
it's just me. Yeah. It's just me on Twitter. I love it.
Yeah, I like that even before we knew what these people were, Cranky Kong is like the original angry retro gamer.
So, Junior actually barely appears in other stuff after this. I mean, like, he's in the N64 Mario Tennis and not any after.
Okay.
And I think after that, since he's in some Game & Watch games that then get remade for Game & Watch Gallery, he's in parts of those as well. But post that, other than, like, him as a statue or, like, as a signpost in other games, he is not, like, a playable guy in games in the last, like, 20 years. Hmm. Pretty much, listeners.
Unless he comes back. I don't know about those awful March of the Minis games or whatever.
They're not awful. They're all right.
Spoken like a British guy.
Leave those minis
Lemmings
alone.
I beat three of those games.
Did we
need eight
of those games? I don't know.
No.
Let me rephrase. The first one where it's a platformer was all right.
Yes,
except
like
for the hideous
one.
Graphics. And then the last one where it was like Pipe Mania and in 3D, that was really cool. But you know, all the other ones were just bad version of Lemmings.
I like the DS one okay, March of the Minis. But yeah,
it's okay.
Also, like, yeah, hey, if I can turn things around for my normal shtick in this episode, that was like Nintendo's American branch being shitty or worse at trying to copy a classic British game in Lemmings. Like,
yeah, NST, yeah. Right?
Yep, yeah, which I don't think exists anymore.
I don't think they're a going concern anymore.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Like, the way this game is made is very funny when you think of it. I mean, we all know more about technology now, where it's just like, we're going to make the most advanced graphics with the most cutting-edge computers in the universe. Oh boy, it's like, you won't even believe how powerful these are. And then we turn them into animated GIFs that a Super Nintendo can display. And that's essentially the making of this game, because they pointed out in various interviews, a screen full of rendered graphics was essentially the size of an SNES card. So they're making this game the same they would make any other game, breaking everything down into tiles and making sure they use the tiles effectively enough that you don't notice that it's repetitive. Now, yeah. I noticed definitely that they had some space issues, because once you get to the winter stages, you realize, like, oh, they didn't make any new, like, winter enemies. I'm still fighting, like, crocodiles and kremlings and all the gang. It's like, they kind of, you can tell that they just used up all of their data here.
I think, yeah, it's like beavers, snakes, and those big wasps, and the necky vultures, and I can't think of any more enemies. Armadillos and the big fellas, that's about it, I think.
I felt like such a rube when I realized the trick of the marketing that this game did. I mean, now, it is even outside of the trick that they were able to make these kind of character models and show them off and then have those basically photographs or memes, or sorry, GIFs, like you said, Bob, exist in the game. That is very impressive. But the advertising where they literally say, this is on the same thing as Jurassic Park, and then, you know, in a game, a magazine, or in a commercial, you see just the still image of the full thing they rendered on the computer. That then when I played the game on my SD television as a kid, I thought, I am looking at the same image. This is the same image, and it's moving in real time, and this is just like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park.
One of the many, many games that benefits enormously from not being on a high-definition display, like in games that use pre-rendered graphics like this, I think that's what they call them, right? You can see artifacting. You can, you know, it doesn't look very good. But when you've got a fuzzy, unclear sort of display, that all blends together. All the color blends together. Everything just looks great, and you know, incredibly atmospheric. It's an atmospheric game. Then when you play it on HDTV, you can see all the seams, and it just doesn't really work.
Yeah, the tricks to all of these pre-rendered games is, like, you must have an SDTV. You must be connecting your SNES via, like, the RF switch, not even just, like, composite cables or whatever, because in the cold light of 2022 on a 4K screen, you can see every bit of dithering, every bit of artifact, and you can see, like, shimmering lines around the characters that you shouldn't have seen before. All of the tricks are on display in front of you, like, the magician is unmasked. You can see everything going on here. But, yeah, it was all a big trick. And I remember it was, like, 1994, and we were doing doing a class project that was like, we're doing a fake time capsule. We're not actually going to bury anything. But what are the three things you would put in it and why? And one of the things I put in, I didn't actually put it in, but say like, oh, Donkey Kong Country should be in it because they made this game with the same computers they used to make Jurassic Park. So I was just parroting the PR lines to my teacher. That's how effective this advertising was.
We were just like Bart saying, buy me Bone Storm or go to hell.
Exactly.
We did what the commercials told us to say.
I was more polite. And it's like, this was the brief window of time in which Jurassic Park comparison could be made. After this, it was like, it's going to be graphics on the par of Toy Story.
Yeah. By the time they were marketing the N64, it was more like, it's made in the same thing as Toy Story, which, yeah, I mean, and then same with Killer Instinct around a little after this. It pretty much just was, it was the same tech as Mortal Kombat, except instead of photographs of human beings in costumes, it was photographs of CGI models. Though, I mean, the CGI models were impressive for their time, and there's something, too, I've seen this going around in the retro spaces recently about how, as much as we like the aesthetic of the sharp edges of a pixel graphic character, a lot of, most of the people who designed those were thinking, well, we make these sharp edges because we know exactly how they will be fuzzed mm-hmm. up on your SD television. It's not meant to be seen in this kind of sharp contrast.
Sometimes my friends hit me because I turn on scan lines and CRT filters when I play video games. They don't understand like I do.
I like seeing the intent, but I'm not a CRT, a devotee. I never want another one in my life as long as I live. I've had enough of those heavy bastards. But yes, the trick works very well. And I mean, just the fact that they were able to make all of these models, a bunch of kids basically, with no training in this software. The documentation was very like technical from an engineering perspective, not from an artist perspective. I saw pictures of the manuals that are like 4 feet high when you stack them all up. No YouTube tutorials, no helpline. They are not just making like, you know, eight balls floating on a checkerboard or whatever, like you're used to seeing in early 3D modeling. They have to make convincing animal characters that animate as well as cartoon characters. And that is an achievement, even though they're taking those models and basically putting photographs of them in a Super Nintendo game.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't want to denigrate their work any by saying, like, well, it's just really a picture. Like, yeah, I don't want to say that. Rare's accomplishment for these kids on like machines, also like they're doing this thousands of miles away from where like these machines were built in Silicon Valley, like
yes.
they can't talk to the people very easily to fix these things.
I guess taking aside issues with the gameplay that we have, you can't fault the like aesthetic ultimately as it was presented back in 1990 when it came out, like both the graphics and the sound were pretty much spectacular. On the SNES, there was nothing like it for several, I guess, ironically, the Toy Story game that came out from Traveler's Tales.
I remember the next year when the Toy Story game came to the Genesis, like some of the previews were saying, like, you know, finally something that looks like Donkey Kong Country could be on the Genesis, you know? Like,
Don't forget Sonic 3D Flicky's Island.
Who could forget?
Just kidding. I've misread this. Definitely forget, I meant to say.
Hey, we can remember Mario RPG. Those are good pre-rendered graphics.
Oof, yeah.
I still love that game so much. Great soundtrack, too.
I love it, too.
I love it. I just wish it didn't look like that.
Yes, it could look better now, but I mean, Rare did take some shortcuts. They had some ideas they stole from other games in development or other games they might have made. The Kremlings are from another project that they were thinking of making. They were trying to get into the point-and-click adventure space, like make a LucasArts-style game. They had something in the works called Johnny Blastoff and the Kremling Armada. And only by hearing British people saying Kremlin did I realize, like, oh, this is a slight against the Russians.
Right.
There are a bunch of Kremlins walking around.
Yeah, I never did either until just now.
And yes, a very good soundtrack on this game because just like with Argonaut Software, they assumed, you know, of course we're going to develop the game, but then, you know, Japan's going to compose for it. But in this case, they said, no, you guys can do it. And Tim Wise, was not working for Rare at the time. He was a freelancer. Like, hey, Tim, write three songs for us, three demos, and we'll see if you're right for the project. He does three demos, and they're like, okay, that's the first song in the game, now write more. Which is why the first song you hear when you play the first level, it doesn't feel like a traditional video game song, because it's like, it's not looping yet, and it starts like a whole another like movement to it. So there's like, it goes through three movements, because it's three different demos that he wrote kind of strung together. Yeah.
But I mean, I just love it that the game starts, you literally explode out of your house like a cannonball, mm-hmm. and you've got those increasing those, and then slowly the backing comes. Oh, it's so good. That first level is a masterpiece. The whole game should just be that one level.
that first level, it gets the game off to a really great start, and it kind of slips up after that. But this is one of the first video game soundtracks that's released in America, is DK Jams, with a Z, of course. Squaresoft in America did start releasing Final Fantasy soundtracks in America, but these are some of the first. Then through Nintendo Power, they start releasing more of these soundtracks through like the Play It Loud brand, which was a very short-lived brand. I think it was July 94 to September of 96, because after that, they're like, we won.
Killer Cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Killer Cuts. That was the... Well, then in 96, that's what... Or maybe it was early 97, I bought the Mario 64 soundtrack and the Wave Race / Mario Kart soundtrack too. But yeah, it's nuts how long it took companies that sell music in America to understand that like gamers want to buy these soundtracks, you know.
And I was a little nerd holding a microphone up to the TV speaker and recording things with it.
Yes.
So the Ambassadors of Funk featuring MC Mario Super doesn't count. That's a different thing, right?
Like, no. Although I put tons of that music in our 500th episode because it rocks.
And did you put Wonder Man by Right Said Fred in there?
I don't think I did.
Obscure reference for you there. Okay.
I don't think I did because he's canceled now.
Yeah, he is.
Oh God, I forgot they're complete twats. I forgot.
Yep.
I forgot. I mentioned them on a podcast recently, and until a comment came in, like, oh right, yeah, they suck. But I think a lot more people learn to appreciate it who maybe missed it, the next generation, because they played Super Smash Brothers Melee a ton, and the soundtrack is all over that. And you, because Sakurai loves video game music, he showcases the DKC music quite a lot.
Yeah, we're not at the rap yet, and that's the only song you should play in any DK level in Smash Brothers.
the UK Nintendo magazine released as a free gift on like a cover mounted gift. A CD of the Smash Brothers orchestra concert that took place. It was absolutely wild. I don't know why, I just was reminded of that. There was a thing, the Donkey Kong designs we were talking about earlier, like the new renders of DK and the design of, say, Diddy Kong, Dixie Kong, all the extended Donkey Kong family. Do you find it as jarring as I do when they show up in Smash Brothers compared to all these like beautifully designed, like Japanese-designed and American-designed game characters? Then you've just got King K. Rool, who's just a fat loser. With like bloodshot eyes, like what's he doing there?
Actually,
he's my main. Obviously, I play as him because he's me. But like, come on.
I remember when King K. Rool was announced, that there was an interview with the original designer, and he was like, "This is like my first attempt at this character. And if I had known he would have gone on for this long, I would have come up with something better. He would have had a better name, because his design makes no sense. Because his chest is made of gold for some reason, but it's not armor, and he's got weird like misshapen eyes, and his name is King K. Rool.
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, it felt like Sakurai didn't want any of the googly-eyed goofballs in his game, and that's why it was so much fun. When the King K. Rool trailer is one of my favorite trailers they ever did for any Smash game, because it's literally like King Dedede, who is voiced by Sakurai and is his insert in that thing. They tease that, oh, King K. Rool's here, and then they're like, ha ha, no, he's not here. You thought we were putting him in the game, and then he actually just does drop down on him, like, no, he really is in the game. And then they did the sequel to that with the Banjo-Kazooie one, where they're just like,
yeah, that was great.
Yeah. They do look wacky as hell.
That trailer, was anyone else horrified when they see King K. Rool, their eyes bug out and they smash through the glass of their house? Like, imagine the pain.
I mean, honestly, that it just called to mind the Uncanny Valley weirdness of the Donkey Kong Country cartoon show from the French.
Oh, yeah. We can be mad at the French for that.
I have never seen that, and I'm thrilled that I've never seen it.
We covered it on this podcast. There's a lot of singing on that show. There's many, many a song is sung.
Really a musical show.
It really is. Diamond, any thoughts on the music? We didn't even cover the underwater music, which is, I think, the most legendary song from the soundtrack. It gets in the, like, the list of what are the best songs of all time in video games, especially of this era. That is one of them.
Yeah, I must say, because I was playing on the Switch, I wasn't really tuned into the music this much on my replay, but I do remember having fond memories of the music when I played it for the first time, and I agree that, the first song kind of has way too much going on in it to be a video game song, but it's also just, it's so good that you don't really care. So I think a lot of the music is actually probably still stuck in my head a little bit, and I just need to unlock it. But ironically, while playing it this time, you know, in my living room while doing other things, I actually didn't listen to the music that much, but I do have positive memories of it.
I mean, I think that they went for the more atmospheric thing here, and then for the sequel, they went for tunes. Like, the sequel is like the one that everyone loves all the music in, because they were all just these great tunes, just like Aquatic Ambience, which I think is what the Coral Capers song is called, because it's one of the only songs in the soundtrack that's a proper actual, like, song, as opposed to, yeah, you know, some ambient atmospherics and a little bit of sort of tinkly music. Some people are going to jump down my throat for saying that, but you know, bring it on.
No, I think the music in this game is pretty ambient and just sort of about evoking a mood and less about putting a catchy tune in your head outside of, like, the first level and the underwater level.
If you want to get another taste of this kind of music, go and buy the port of Donkey Kong Country 3 on the Game Boy Advance. It came out right at the end of the Game Boy Advance's life, because it has a completely new redone soundtrack by David Wise. They took out Evelyn Fisher's music, threw it in the bin, set fire to the bin, kicked the bin into a bigger bin, then set that on fire. And then they put all these new songs in it. And the new songs have, for example, yodeling, an extended pause where all you can hear is the wind blowing harshly. Then some distant Christmassy music that sounds like it's being played in the next village, and you can only just hear it. The sound of saws soaring, that's another thing that he uses. It's a very interesting soundtrack, and I recommend you play that.
Now that I think about it, the one song that stood out to me the most was when I finally got to the last boss, and it's like a pirate sea shanty, even though it's a very strange finale, because you go up the mountain, and I sort of, probably because I was thinking of Yoshi's Island, I assumed you would go up to the top of the island and then you would change and you'd come back down the island. But no, you go up the top of the island, then you go one square over to the ship that's always been there. And the last stage is, there is no world. There's just one last stage where you fight King K. Rool. And yeah, he's a king, but he's on a pirate ship. And yeah, the music is very piratey, and you're kind of like, this is it? Is this the end? This is the end. That music to me struck out as kind of, it's fun, it's bubbly, but it's kind of like, we're finishing the game, this is the end. Okay, all right, well, I'm jumping.
That's one of the most famous Donkey Kong Country songs, and it gets reused as well quite a lot in different things. And then, of course, the pirate theme they leaned into more with Donkey Kong Land, which has a pirate-themed level, actual levels. And then in Donkey Kong Country 2, K. Rool is, in fact, a pirate. So it's like they kind of, which makes this feel even more like a tech demo now that I think about it.
We ran out of pirate ideas, but yeah, the Game Boy games have very good music as well, because it's like the same kind of sentiment. It's the same kind of sentiment, but on an 8-bit music hardware.
And
I want to cover one thing.
Beautiful graphics.
They're trying real hard on that Game Boy. But yeah, I want to cover one more thing before we get into the release and the marketing, and then close out here. In that there is controversy about this game in Miyamoto, because for the longest time, little stinkers who didn't like this game very much, or like Yoshi's Island more, I'm one of them.
Me too.
We would say, you know, Miyamoto actually doesn't like this game, and he was quoted to say that Donkey Kong Country proves that players will put up with mediocre gameplay as long as the art is good. And no one ever actually bothered looking up if he's actually said that quote until 2019, as far as I can tell. Apparently, Miyamoto was said to have said this in an issue of Electronic Games in, I believe, May of 95 or something like that. And to think about it now, it's just like, it would be weird if Miyamoto would be slamming that holiday's biggest seller, something he had his hand in, something his name is on.
That would be the first time he ever would say something that inelegant or mean about one of his things. Like, it's also like, even in interview, it does seem silly now that we all accept that, because we've all read so many interviews of Japanese developers. Even if they didn't like something, they would never be that blunt about not liking it.
It doesn't ring true at all, I don't think, personally. It's something you want to believe is true if you want to believe that But if you do prefer Yoshi's Island and you're sort of weirdly obsessed about it, I guess.
Yes. We kind of were.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
mean,
well,
yeah.
Yeah.
Frank Cifaldi, our friend of the show here at the Game History Organization, he basically had access to this magazine as of like 2019. I'm sure it wasn't that hard to find, but he's like, oh, I just came into possession of this. And they're like, oh, check the magazine. Did he say this quote? And he's like, there's nothing like that in there. So he actually never said this quote. It's so apocryphal. I want to know who we have to like comb the news groups and find the liar who put this online. But he did address this in 2010 when Donkey Kong Returns was coming out. Somebody finally asked him about this, and this is what he said. Quote, Miyamoto says, the first point I want to make is that I actually worked very closely with Rare on the original Donkey Kong Country. And I apparently recently some rumor got out that I really didn't like the game. I just want to clarify that's not the case because I was very involved in that and even emailing almost daily with Tim Stamper right up until the end. So there you have it on the record. A, it was never quoted. He was never quoted to say that. B, yes, he's promoting a new game, but he was as hands-on as he could be in Japan, even though Rare was left up to their own devices a lot in Twycross.
The Miyamoto Rare interaction I want confirmed to be true is that he said that the ending of GoldenEye 007 should have 007 visiting all the people he shot in the hospital and shaking their hands.
I hope that's true.
I want to believe that's another fun story.
I desperately want that to be true.
Well, he was kind of shocked by the violence in Rare games because in the original like preview builds of Donkey Kong Country 64 or Donkey Kong 64, whatever it's called, the guns were real guns. They weren't like coconut guns. And Miyamoto's like, can it shoot peanuts maybe?
Yeah, I'm so glad he said that. That was, I miss Iwata Asks so much. Those were so great. But yeah, the Donkey Kong Country, Miyamoto would feel ownership over it to a certain degree because it happened with his permission. Like he oversaw it. He's an executive producer on the game and you don't, I mean, unless you're a real jerk, you don't talk that kind of crap about a successful thing you were an executive producer on, you know, like, it would be so out of character. But yeah, like you said, Bob, I wanted to believe because the schoolyard fight was we loved our crayon colorful Yoshi Island game from the next year. And people said that was dumb and for babies and the Donkey Kong Country was way better and you drew up battle lines. And so we wanted to believe that, well, actually the god of gaming, the only person we know who makes video games, Shigeru Miyamoto, he actually hates Donkey Kong Country. So there.
And Yoshi's Island was in production for a very, very long time, especially at the time, especially for a platformer. I think even via the Nintendo leak, it's been revealed that as early as 1991, this game was in development. So like 4 years on a platformer. And obviously, while they're working on it, Donkey Kong Country becomes a huge hit. It's too late for them to go back and make it a pre-rendered game. But I think that's why they overcompensate in a good way with the 2D graphics. I think they said to themselves, I don't think this is an insane speculation, but we can't make this pre-rendered. Let's do as much as we can with 2D graphics. This is our last statement about 2D graphics because they won't exist anymore. That's as far as they knew, they wouldn't exist anymore.
They had the FX2 chip as well, obviously, with the extremely impressive effects of morphing and stretching and things. And I know it's not a Yoshi's Island podcast, but the fact that we went from Mario World to Mario World 2, which looks like it came from a completely different, much more advanced console as far as I'm concerned, is wild, with Donkey Kong Country in between. It's just kind of, the SNES was off the chain. Like, it was absolutely nuts.
I will say, to be fair to Donkey Kong Country, Yoshi's Island is sort of on the other end of the spectrum in that there's almost too many ideas in that game to the point where I need to like build up confidence to play Yoshi's Island again. You have to put a lot of yourself into it. But if you look at just how complex that game is, just like every boss is a different idea. In Donkey Kong Country, it's like you just jump on a head three times and you're out of there.
The bosses are trash.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to agree with you. I wrote about this on Retronauts that Yoshi's Island, I think, is a masterpiece. Like, it's an incredible game. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. You can complain about the baby sound effect, but just don't get hits. Like, you know, don't get hit. Be cool like me. But I don't want to play it anymore because once you've done it 100 points, going back and not doing it 100 points feels like you're doing it wrong. And getting 100 points is really stressful. Whereas Donkey Kong Country, I can bop through that game, not give a shit, and get to the end in like an hour, and then play it again, and it's going to be just as fun for me. I don't think it's a better game, but I think it's more enticing to revisit just to have a little sesh on a 2D platformer.
Can we talk about the bosses, though? I think we probably should talk about the bosses because, you know, speaking of time saving. You know,
no, I'm kidding, sorry.
Speaking of,
on the Yoshi's Island topic, I did want to mention real quick that, like, I was so into this battle that the first time I ever got to interview Takashi Tezuka at E3 2012, what was ostensibly, I got a whole hour with him and got to, it was talking about the just announced Wii U, Super Mario Brothers 2, all this stuff. And I was like, okay, but at the end, I have set aside 5 minutes at the end to ask him about Yoshi's Island, because like, you're the director of Yoshi's Island, right? Like, and that was, you know, really hard. This is my favorite game. And I asked him, like, you know, I wish I could. I could not find my original article, so I can't source myself directly. But I basically asked him, was Yoshi's Island made in response to Donkey Kong Country? And he did allude that some... Now, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he alluded that some decisions were made in reaction to it. But
yeah.
I definitely agree with this, not just what Miyamoto said, but also that the provable timeline of Yoshi's Island existed long before it existed before Donkey Kong Country even was made, yeah, let alone a success. So, but I do think some choices were probably made at least partly as a reaction.
Yeah,
to
I
it.
Think graphically, I think it's why there's a pre-rendered sequence up front to let you know, like, we're aware this exists. You won't see it in the game. Stuart, go ahead.
The Giga Leak showed something called Super Donkey, that I think it was called, which looks like a very early Yoshi's Island with a very unusual looking character. And, you know, obviously being called Super Donkey, that raises a pretty obvious flag. And I do wonder what was going on there. You know, I do wonder if Yoshi's Island was ever at any point a Donkey Kong game. Because, you know, you're throwing stuff. Donkey Kong throws stuff. You know, he throws barrels. He doesn't throw eggs unless something's gone horribly wrong.
Well, if you try to investigate this, Nintendo might take your YouTube video down. So.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Careful.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but yeah, Diamond, you were talking about the boss fights, and they are very simple, although I was a 12-year-old boy at the time. My friend and I love walking up to each other and saying, Necky's nuts. that was a little joke we had, because, you know, I mean, Rare is naming things after dicks and balls. They're not above this. But Diamond, please, boss chat, they're pretty bad, right?
Yeah, well, as you said, a lot of this stuff was just, you know, once you make the model, then you've made it. So it's like, you've got a giant beaver, which is the same, it's just, you know, small enemy becomes big enemy. You've got the giant vulture, who's like, I think that's an original model, but it certainly is based off the smaller model. Then you've got the giant bee wasp thing. You've got the giant barrel. Your one boss fight is literally just a barrel that comes down. And
with eyes. Yeah.
You have to dodge the barrel long enough, and the barrel just explodes. Like it gets bored of its own boss fight and just gives up. And then...
I have to say, the barrel doesn't even have eyes. It really doesn't. It's just a barrel with a skull and crossbones on it. It's rubbish. It doesn't even animate.
Oh, wow.
Then you fight the beaver again.
There's a drum with eyes in the third game.
Then you fight the beaver again. Then you fight the vulture again.
Yeah, but it's changed.
Like, they're different colors.
It's Necky's nuts, and Necky's nuts, and it's naughty beaver, and very naughty beaver.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
So,
get it? Do you get the joke? Because naughty, because they like to gnaw on things. Yeah, that's very funny.
But what I'm saying is, so you go through all this stuff, so the only really original boss is the last boss, and in my opinion, he's the only one that actually has genuine challenge. Like, the other ones, the only real challenge from the other boss fights is, like, can you tell when the boss's iframes are not? Because they give you no indication of when they're invincible. You might, you know, you'll jump on their head and you do damage. Jump on their head this time, it's like, oh, no, they laugh this time, and they keep moving, so they run you over. It's like, well, they're not blinking or anything. There's no indication that they are invincible. When do I jump on them? So it's like, that's, you know, that to me was a little bit frustrating. But so to me, King K. Rool was much more sensible, I think, because, like, he's wearing the crown, and clearly you can't jump on him when he's wearing the crown. So you, like... when he throws the crown, that's your chance to hit him. But then there are other parts where he just is standing there wearing the crown. He's not doing anything. He's standing there while, like, things fall on you. And I know for me as a kid, I was like, why can't I hit him? Why can't I roll it? Why can't I do anything? No, I'd have to wait for him. I have to wait for him to take his crown off. That's the only time you can hit him. But at least the game tells you this is what you do and sticks with it.
Did you ever get fooled by the fake credits when you
beat
him?
Let me tell you, I completely bought it this time. I completely forgot about that joke. So when I beat the game this time and the credits started, I'm like, oh wow, that was pretty fast. And wait, they're joke credits? What is this, Castlevania? And then he gets up, it's like, oh, they fooled me. They fooled me.
I honestly love that. I love stuff like that. That made me really happy.
It's part of Rare's very cheeky sense of humor. But yeah, the bosses, yeah. I mean, like, the beaver just wanders back and forth. The bee fight, you're fighting a parabola. Just like, can you stand in the right spot? they're all very, very simple. But again, they didn't have time to actually think of, like, to reinvent the platformer. They were reinventing the graphics first. And then with the second game, it's when they start developing better game design ideas.
November 21st is coming soon. You know, they gotta. They can't miss that ship date.
We have to wrap up soon. Oh, go ahead, Stuart.
No, I would say, like I said already, but the second game, honestly, it's like in terms of almost everything that people value, it's leagues ahead of the first one. Everything feels more consistent and thoughtful. The difficulty, while it's still high, feels a lot more measured. But we'll probably presumably talk about that on a dedicated podcast at some point.
Oh, for sure.
We'll slap it together with the third one.
Yes, they can both be together with no Donkey Kong because he's not present. Let's wrap up here by talking about the release and the marketing. So this game was revealed at the 1994 CES. That was before E3. And it was the final part of Nintendo's presentation that year. And apparently, they didn't reveal this was going to be an SNES game until the very end of, like, the Donkey Kong Country reel. And that stunned the crowd. It's one of those things where I wish there was a camera in the audience.
Oh, hell yeah.
I saw footage of that CES from the floor, but there was no footage of this presentation.
Yeah, that description, like, I feel like I read that exact thing in EGM or Ultra, or well, no, it would have been just Game Players at the time. But that's that description of, like, and by the way, this isn't on a next gen. So, like, this is a Super NES. You don't have to buy. And that was so key to their marketing to just tell you, especially because they were fighting against Sega trying to tell. It was such a great attack on Sega trying to sell an add-on that they have to just show, like, their commercials. Look how awesome that looks. And you don't got to buy any add-on. You don't got to buy a new system. It'll just play in Super NES. It can look like this.
Yes, they're really shocked.
I remember that being in the magazine ads. That was a major factor of just like, yep, this is a Super NES game. Like, no bullshit.
And yeah, Nintendo needed to show the world just what they had created with Rare. And part of this, they did this via VHS tape sent out to Nintendo Power subscribers. I believe this was the first one out of like five or six they would send out. There was one for like Star Fox 64, one for like Mario 64, and so on, like Banjo-Kazooie. We all know the John Lovitz narrated Banjo-Kazooie video, of course.
Oh my God, I have to see this.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, you gotta, yeah.
Does he do it in his ridiculous like Simpsons character voices? That would be great.
Well, yes, I mean, just his voice. He only has one.
Yeah.
This was the first one. Because this promotional tape worked on me and my brother so well to rent it. We didn't buy it, like I said, but we rented it. Like, it was a free rental. The commercial was a free rental at Blockbuster. Like, Mom, look, it's a tape that's free. Rent it. Like, let's rent it. And, like, yeah, of course the commercial is free.
It was the How to Buy Action Figure Man special.
You know what's kind of wild is I'm pretty sure I had this tape and I didn't have a Super Nintendo. I definitely didn't buy it. And I definitely didn't get it off a magazine, so it just somehow appeared in my home.
Well, this special, I skimmed through it. I recall watching it like back in the day when I was doing retro research for something, but it's hosted by this very Pucci-style Gen X comedian with like a backwards head and long hair, and he's like totally on the edge, and he's talking to very meek Nintendo employees. But A, I'm glad that they talked to a Rare employee, but B, it ends with a very surprising thing in which he's like, let's go into this room, guys, and it's like a bunch of people playing Killer Instinct on what then was going to be the Ultra 64, and they're like, no, get out of the room, no. So it was like a secret sneak preview for Killer Instinct, a version that would never exist because the N64 wasn't ready. They had to make Killer Instinct for the Super Nintendo in 1995 instead.
Yeah, that post-credit scene they did blew my mind as a kid. I didn't even know what exactly. Well, it was like a year later when they started advertising Killer Instinct for like the arcades that I realized what it was.
They showed Donkey Kong with one of the Infinity Stones. It thrilled us all.
The contrast, though, this is 94. When Killer Instinct comes to any SNES in 1995, like that's a game that is so super downsized from the high end machines it was made on. Like that game even at the time, I was kind of like, this doesn't look very good. Like, I'm having fun playing it, but this can't even compare to that arcade machine. And so I feel like whatever magic happened with Donkey Kong Country, but even 1 year later, like, my eyes were kind of like, this doesn't, it's just a bunch of GIFs, isn't it? Or I didn't know the word at the time.
It next to the gorgeous Battle Arena Toshinden could not compare.
Yeah. Yes. You know, I never played the arcade game, so I just like seeing pre-rendered things on my screen. Like, this is really cool. But also, Donkey Kong Country had a $60 million marketing budget, which is about three times the average marketing budget at that time. And it sold this game based on the technology that made it, which technically wasn't a lie. And yes, this was the "we made this with Jurassic Park stuff" kind of pitch to everybody. And of course, every preview regurgitated this, every review did. Hey, it was like eight free words in your 300-word write-up. What are you going to do, not include the PR marketing?
That you probably got paid like $600 to write in 92 money.
Maybe like $10,000. These people are rolling in the dough. One of the earliest and biggest games in the Play It Loud era, which only lasted until September of 96 because Nintendo moved on with the N64. It's like Play It Loud was just trying to compete with Genesis and their bullshit, and they're like, okay, we won the screaming contest. Now we're moving on to the N64 in happier times. And yeah, Nintendo released Donkey Kong Country right under the wire for the Christmas shopping season on November 21st, 94. And this went on to sell a little over 9 million copies in its lifetime, which means close to half of all SNES owners actually purchased this game.
An incredible number.
Yeah.
Yeah, really? Just like, it's still floating around at every used game store. That one is not a collectible used game just yet.
Are there any SNES games that sold higher that weren't pack-ins than this game?
No, this is number three. It might have been a pack-in at some point, but this is number three. Number one's Mario World. Number two is Mario All-Stars, and I think that was a pack-in.
Wow. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Wow. Okay.
I was reading up on the release of this game and the context around it, and this is around the time when, you know, the normies were finding out about video games. Like, these things are big business for Nintendo, and there were stories like, in its second week, this game outgrossed the highest-grossing movie and the highest-grossing album that week, and that was the Santa Claus, the Tim Allen movie, and some Kenny G crap for Christmas.
It's Christmas.
Yeah.
That's Christmas 94, man. We were listening to Kenny G. We left the Santa Claus screening and then wrote a letter to Santa saying, send me Donkey Kong Country.
Or go to hell.
Yeah.
I still see these stories a lot. I remember like when Final Fantasy VII came out in 97, it's like, this be G.I. Jane. Did you realize that? Like, oh no, not the biggest movie of all time, G.I. Jane. But you still hear like about big launches and how they're bigger than movies. And like, yeah, folks, we know video games, they cost $60, a ticket costs $15, and people buy a lot of these things, so let's all calm down a little bit.
Bob, I'd like to congratulate you for being the second person in 2022 to reference G.I. Jane and the first one to not get hit for doing it.
Henry, there's a table between us. I can tell Henry's a big G.I.J. fan, a G.I. Jane fan. He almost did slap me.
Keep G.I. Jane out of your damn mouth.
What a lame joke. You know what? He should have been slapped for a G.I. Jane reference in 2022.
You know, that was his defense.
That was this year?
That was this year?
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, his defense was, that joke sucks. Yeah. thank you, Bruce Valanche. So moving on, more context. It's so delicious. Sega is not doing bad, but they're investing too much in failed hardware add-ons. Nintendo comes out the clear winner without having to invest in new hardware quite yet.
The mistakes have begun. Like, it's not that Sega lost it, but Nintendo did beat them. Like, Donkey Kong Country sold better, and they kept going. But it did not help that their 95 was, like, it just was crappier. Like, they didn't have the thing. They didn't have a Sonic ready, and they thought...
They kind of got bodied by Donkey Kong Country and the PlayStation, sort of more or less in the same year, just by some guy saying, like, $399.
Yeah. Let's go over what was happening in the world at the time, in the console world. I mean, Nintendo doing very well without having to put out a new console. So Sega Saturn launches in Japan a day after Donkey Kong Country,
has a
disastrous secret launch in May of 95, the exclusive Toys R Us launch. We all know about that. The Sony PlayStation launches in Japan a few weeks after Donkey Kong Country, has a fairly successful launch in America that fall. The 32X launches the same day as this game in America. Uh-oh, bad idea.
Like I said, those
with
ads.
What? What are you going to play on the damn thing?
Star Wars Arcade.
Can you still do that?
Did that launch with it? What
launched
with the 32X? I have to know. Probably nothing, knowing them.
Well, I just remember, 32X was like a free commercial for Donkey Kong. Like, that was so clear a thing of like, Yeah. Oh, you don't. You can play this thing that looks great, and you don't have to buy another thing to put on top of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can buy this mushroom for your Mega Drive and play Cosmic Carnage with your soon-to-be ex-friends.
They will never come back. And also, yeah, Atari Jaguar and 3DO have been out for a year, but who cares? Yeah. I mean, we had our laughs, right? But nobody cares about those consoles, and no. Especially at the time. I played these at the time, and even then I was like, I like my Super Nintendo.
The
Bob,
three games that
infuriated the 3DO community. You know?
I know they're listening.
The very limited number of good games that were on those things, like say Ray-Ban, then instantly comes to every other system. One other person or game that was that felt the pain of Donkey Kong Country I wanted to mention was Earthworm Jim, because it did do really well, but it was very outsold by Donkey Kong Country. And
it was
so,
also 94?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought so.
So when the Sega CD version of Earthworm Jim came out a little later, within a year later, there is a secret input you can put into it that will give him basically Donkey Kong's head, but with an arrow through the top of his head, because they were as their little middle finger to Donkey Kong.
Yeah,
it was
in the PC version. I had the special edition, and in that you just type Queen Slug Furbot's name. She has like millions of names, and one of those gives you the Donkey Kong arrowhead. Bit of trivia for Retronauts there.
Well, the creator of Donkey Kong Country did not yell at me online like the creator of Earthworm Jim. So
it's another plus for Donkey Kong.
Yeah. Doug Tenapple yells at someone online?
That seems crazy.
Stop the presses. I think
there's
I have
another
him blocked.
Guy who's a complete loser.
Let's not even say it. Yeah. This is a whole other
It's why
podcast.
I don't want to do an Earthworm Jim episode.
Well, on the plus side, at least Tommy Tallarico is untouchable. Oh, no.
Yes. Oh, right. He's a man who'd never lie.
Man, you know what sucks? Is like I love that game. And like, I also love Days Gone, and the guy who directed that this week has gone insane as well, and it's just horrible. Like, what am I going to play next and find out that the guy who made it is just another complete tool? It's going to suck.
Well, you know, now that free speech is legal on Twitter, we have to watch out.
Yeah, comedy and free speech are legal again. Yes. That's just how it's going
to
be.
And we can't take it. Yeah. And I guess to wrap up, you know, we'll talk more about Donkey Kong Country as the years of Retronauts go by, but this would not stop here. There would be multiple sequels. They were even annual at first. There's going to be spinoffs. And this version of Donkey Kong is going to be the Donkey Kong for the rest of time. It's going to find its way into a ton of Nintendo productions, even things made in Japan. Diddy is around as well in those productions. And also, there was a decade of dormancy between Donkey Kong Country Returns and Tropical Freeze. No, wait. We are living in that period. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I misread
my
notes. So, yeah, there was like... there was about a decade between 64 and Returns, and then there was like 4 years, and then it was Tropical Freeze, and now we are almost 10 years out from Tropical Freeze. And again, that is my favorite Donkey Kong Country game, and it's like the one Wii U game for Switch I have not repurchased yet. It will break me, but guess what, guys? It's on sale this week for $40.
Wow, that's as cheap as it's ever going to be. Yeah.
I just want to get this episode out with my hot take before we wrap it up, which is I didn't like Tropical Freeze very much. Boom. All right, moving on.
Aww. Wow, damn. I thought it was great. I was like, you did something right, and I finally like this. It took a different developer to make it, I guess. But boy, it's such a dense game with like just so many features, so many different like play styles, and the bosses are so good too. But I feel like I would not be surprised at this point if there was Nintendo Direct soon, early in the new year maybe, and they say, you know, coming for the Switch in its final days, a new Donkey Kong Country game, because there has not been a new one for the Switch, and technically it will be 9 years in February, so the clock's a ticking, and I think it's time, and these are still very popular games. There's a lot of nostalgia for the old ones as well.
And Retro Studios must be doing something. Like,
I hope so.
They still employ people. They got to be making something.
They put them on Metroid Prime 4, didn't they? I imagine that. They reset development and stuck them on that.
They're rendering a new logo right now for E3.
Yeah.
Oh, and one more thing. We've changed the font on the Metroid 4 logo.
Oh, and one more thing. Metroid Prime 4 is canceled.
They should just let us know. But yeah, those are my final thoughts. I think this is a flawed game, but it's the game it needed to be at the time. They did not have time to develop new gameplay ideas. It was all about putting the technology first. And then you can see how throughout time they've iterated on this concept and made it into a much better series. But yeah, I really think about being 12 years old when I play this. Some good and bad memories. But that's my only thoughts about DKC in this 2-hour podcast. Anyone else have final thoughts? Let's go to Stuart. How about you?
Yes, we've made it through this entire podcast without mentioning the sexy chimpanzee Candy Kong.
Oh, I wanted to avoid this.
Yeah, well, that's okay, because that's all I'm going to say about Candy Kong. And I mean, she speaks for herself, I believe. No, my final thoughts is what I said. I think it is a game that is laden with issues in terms of gameplay. For me, they don't kill it. I do still enjoy playing it, with the exception of like a couple of levels, because the forward momentum is just that quick. It is just that breezy of a game. I don't find it as difficult as y'all do, but
that's how we talk.
That's not because I'm like skill. It's just I've played it a lot, so I know all its stupid dumb tricks. Plus, as I mentioned, I had the strategy guide before I even played the game. So, yeah, I like it a lot. I go back to it a lot because it does. It is almost the last hurrah before collectathons take over, and I kind of appreciate that. Like, even Yoshi's Island is a collectathon, as much as I love it. It's fun. I like it. I like probably the Game Boy Advance port slightly more, because they put the quality of life changes in a bit, add a few more things to find. I'm probably still go back to it for many years to come. Plus, you know, apes are cool.
They are. Diamond, how about you?
Well, I must say, so I'm not hurting for choices. There's so many things just within arm's reach of me right now that I could be playing right now. So I didn't have to beat Donkey Kong Country to have this podcast. But once I started playing it, I did have fun with it. I did enjoy it. Certainly, I have some of that is nostalgia-based. But I think the game overall is fun. I just think, yeah, it doesn't hold up so well, you know, years later, both graphically and design-wise, because, you know, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, oh boy, it came out after this game, which was kind of better than it. And the next year later was a game that was really incredible. But it is sort of its own thing. I think, Bob, I really appreciate you mentioning the indiness of it. Because, yeah, it does sort of keep itself to one, you know, one general idea. You know, the animal friends come up, but the animal friends are kind of used sparingly, and they don't really transform the game so much. Donkey Kong himself, Donkey Kong, Diddy Kong, whatever, they never really get new powers. Like, there's no Fire Flower, there's no Invincible Star. Like, you're never invincible, really. Even the animal friends don't make you invincible. They just make you stronger. Mm-hmm. So I had a good time with it, and I think it is fun. And honestly, you know, you're not the first person to tell me that Tropical Freeze is great, so I will drop that much money on Tropical Freeze. But just to address
it will never be less than $40.
Just to address it before we get past this, we need to point out Candy Kong is the only one in the game who's actually wearing clothing, which means the rest of them are nude. That's it. They're nude.
Mm-hmm.
She's the only non-sexy one.
Well, at least bottomless. Like, you know, we know the... Diddy wears a nice little shirt and hat
and
with the Nintendo logo.
Diamond, did you say you 100% of the game?
No,
well?
I didn't. No, not in 94 I did. Now.
I see. I was going to say, I want to get it on the record that the way that you get 101% or 105% in this game is the most patently unreasonable thing that no one would ever find without a magazine, which is one of the bonus rooms. You have to finish it with a single banana outcome rather than one of the good outcomes, which then gives you a barrel that you use to break through to the next bonus room. Then you do the same thing again, then you break through to another bonus room, which is completely undocumented, and then you get 105%. No one would ever find that. It's rubbish. It's like pure British game design at its worst.
Miyamoto did not find that before the game shipped. Henry, final thoughts. Do you want to apologize to the British, especially Stuart?
I apologize to you and your wonderful king. May your majesty...
Fuck him.
No, I kid. But I... Like, to the point that I used one of the most high profile interviews I had to that point as a way to ask about it. I have always been tied up in viewing, you know, Yoshi's Island and also Donkey Kong 94 for Game Boy versus this game, and I prefer those games to this game by a wide margin, but I feel like that has always clouded me of judging Donkey Kong Country on its own merits, not to mention as its own, like, you know, just huge moment in games, and that had a gigantic effect on games. Like, it changed how so many games were marketed, like the 3D, the things. It was the not the first thing, but it was a preview of what 1995 was going to be all about with game ads, of just like, no, everything has to be 3D now. Everything looks stupid if it's not 3D. Like, in Donkey Kong and its country and its huge success is a big, big part of it. And yeah, I mean, as somebody who loves the trivial, stupid canon and continuity of the Donkey Kong world, I have to appreciate the Donkey Kong Country added so much weirdness to it of like, was Cranky Kong the original Donkey Kong? Is Donkey Kong Donkey Kong Jr. grown up? These questions that will never truly be answered.
Not until we do a paternity test. Yeah, I mean, it's a simple game. We talked about it for 2 hours, so hats off to Donkey Kong Country. But thanks for listening, folks. We are a fan-supported podcast. We're Retronauts, by the way, in case you forgot. It's been 2 hours. You can find us online at Retronauts on Twitter. And yes, if you want to support the show and get these episodes 1 week ahead of time and ad-free, please go to patreon.com/retronauts. Sign up there for $3 a month. You can adjust that. But also, there's a $5 tier. It's where you want to be, because on that $5 tier, you get early access and also 2 full-length bonus episodes every month, and also a bonus essay and podcast by Diamond Fight here. And we've been doing this for 3 years now, 3 years total. We're coming to the end of our 3rd year. So there has been 2 exclusive episodes every month for 3 complete years. So if you're not on the $5 tier, you missed a lot of great episodes, and they're all available to you instantly the second you sign up for $5 a month at patreon.com/retronauts. That's it for our plugs. Thanks so much for listening to Retronauts. As for our personal plugs, Diamond, how about you? What's going on with Diamond Fight?
Well, you mentioned the column, actually, and 2 hours ago you mentioned Kangaroo. I actually covered Kangaroo in the column at the start of this year, because that was an arcade game I played a lot when I was a child. So, and very Donkey Kong adjacent, although there's no barrels. But yes,
it needs barrels.
You can find me on the internet in various places, Twitter for now, presumably tomorrow as well. Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that's my last name, C-L-U-B, a blunt weapon that an ape might use, but not in this game.
And Stuart, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Chupacabra, an incredibly clever portmanteau of my name and the word Chupacabra there. You probably shouldn't follow me on Twitter though, because I'm really just terrible on there. Like, all my worst excesses are brought to light. I should probably plug the book, shouldn't I? I've done a book for Press Run, Limited Run Games. It's called All Games Are Good, and it's out in 2023. I want to say sort of mid-year, summer sort of time. So get excited and stay excited for many, many months, please.
And Henry, how about you?
Well, if you liked hearing me and Bob talk about stuff on this, you should definitely check out the Talking Simpsons Podcast Network, where me and Bob do that all the time. We, on the Talking Simpsons Podcast, go chronologically through the entire series of Simpsons, super duper in depth, full of great research, just like Bob did in this episode of Retronauts. And you can also listen to our What a Cartoon podcast, where we do the same for animated series, and What a Cartoon Movie, where we do it for animated feature films. Look for Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon wherever you find podcasts, and that's all supported at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. If you sign up there, you hear all of our podcasts a week early, and each month you get an episode of Talking Futurama, of Talk King of the Hill, and we closed out 2022 with our newest season of Blabbin' Bout Batman, the animated series, talking about 8 of our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series. We have so much fun talking about that. Please see it all for yourself at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, and you can follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG.
And of course, I'm on Twitter too as Bob Servo. But that's it for this episode of Retronauts. We'll see you again soon for another new episode. Thanks for listening.